just an imbecile. I will only complicate you. Trust in me and fall as well. I will find a center in you. I will chew it up and leave. Trust me, trust me.
HD1 Detroit. Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 248-544-WRIF. That's 248-544-9743. Or text the RIF at 4WRIF. That's 49743. Night Call is on the air. Here are your hosts, Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome, everybody. Great Sunday, and hey, you are our co-star, so please join us at 248-544-WRIF, which is...
It is 248-544-9-9740.
Three. What have you been drinking?
Nothing. I went to your house for dinner. You're the one who had wine.
I did. 248-944-9743.
No. It's not 248-944. It's 248-544-9743. We swear we haven't been drinking.
All right, here we go. It's 248-544-WRIF or
248-544-9743.
There you go. It's a new number, so that's why we're fumbling. Of course,
I didn't have it in front of me.
After a few weeks, the excuse gets a little weak, doesn't it?
I don't know. Not when you've been... Using the same phone number for decades.
Decades, yeah. Hey, this is a phone-in talk show, and we get your opinions on what's happening in the world. Or, hey, right around the block, Detroit, you know, a lot to talk about. You can join us on Facebook. A lot of people, all of a sudden, just taking off. Facebook.com/nightcall. And since really what this is all about is just this big vanity thing for me and Jalene, we have a photograph of the two of us. At dinner at my house, it looks like a Chinese restaurant.
It does.
Because there's I don't know what it is. It's calligraphy. Actually, it's original.
It's beautiful.
Stuff. Our friend Kathy, you know, she took a course in calligraphy and did this Chinese poem.
It's very nice. And but we really ate Mediterranean.
We did. Yeah. We did.
Yeah, it's delicious. Yeah. I said, Peter, why don't I come over? Why don't we cook? And guess who cooked?
Yeah, me. But you can see it at Facebook.com/nightcall. And if you text us at 4WRIF, that sounds like the state, doesn't it? Text us.
Like the state?
Texas.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Give us a text.
Yeah, 49743, and we actually know how to get into it this time. And we know how to get into our email.
I feel like we're sailing. We're back. We're back on.
We had
some glitches.
Call Talk Yes.
Technological glitches.
Yeah, forget that Gmail stuff. CallTalkYes@yahoo.com. That's the one that it always has been for so long. So, indeed, please join us, and we're going to introduce some subjects, but you may as well. People still going round and round about the health care law, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, And it's interesting. Almost everybody I run into personally are all excited about getting it, including people that are going to wind up paying 50% less. But I was I had breakfast that my wife and I did with two people who are in the medical profession, and they said everybody at the hospital hates it. But it could be because of its complexity. I don't know.
It is complex, and people oftentimes don't like change whatsoever.
No, I know. Well, I think all the people that don't have health insurance of any kind.
You're talking to her.
Yeah, yeah. So you're going to go on one of those exchanges.
I'm gonna look into it, definitely, yes.
But you're not rushing this website.
Well, you can't rush to it because it's not happening.
I don't get it. People hear that this website isn't working, and then they rush to it.
I'm waiting for everything to shake out. I've been saying that every week.
Yeah, everybody should do that. Just don't even bother with it. I think now you have till March 31st.
Yeah.
Anyways, to enroll.
Right.
But Kathleen Sebelius, who is the Health and Human Services Secretary, who the right-wingers, the teabaggers, and the Republicans, those are all the same, aren't they? Are going after her, saying she should resign because there's so many problems with Obamacare. And there's so many problems with Obamacare is because the Republicans did everything they could to make sure that it didn't work. And if there are inherent problems with it, which I think there are, and a lot of people on the left think there is, then the Republicans should be about trying to fix this, not to create a situation where, and this is what their main goal is, to have a political defeat for President Obama. And so his last term in office will be ruined, and then that will increase their chances for regaining a presidency in 2016. And this is so cynical, given the fact that there's 40 to 50 million people without health insurance, including one who I'm looking at right now.
Right now. And, it's also just so predictable, Peter. We could expect nothing less from these people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they don't care. They don't care about 50... They don't care about those 50 million people at all.
Now, one of the things that has really set the Republicans on edge, and a lot of Americans as well, is that President Obama made this blanket statement that all Americans would be allowed to keep their insurance policies if they liked them. That's an interesting, what did he say? And he said, period. And John Stewart said, why is he reading the punctuation marks?
He's just trying to make a point.
Yeah, he said that everybody will be able to keep their current policy, period. I don't know if let me just read into this article. Where is this from? It's from the editor's blog of the New York Times. Okay. And he said, most lawmakers mentioned President Obama's unfortunate blanket statement that all Americans would be allowed to keep their insurance policies if they liked them. Well, all right. The president failed to make an exception for inadequate policies that don't meet new minimum standards. And that's why people are being forced off of it. Because,
more they need to change it,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Kathleen Sebelius managed to make an important point. Since, yes, some people will be forced to upgrade their policies, she said, but that's preferable to the status quo before the passage of the Affordable Care Act, when insurers could cancel policies on a whim. And they did it all the time. Here's what she said. The individual market in Kansas and anywhere in the country has never had consumer protections. People are on their own. They could be locked out, priced out, dumped out, and that happened each and every day. She means before Obamacare. So this will finally provide the kind of protections that we all enjoy in our health care plans. She says, a true cancellation is when someone gets a letter saying she's losing her insurance and cannot renew. They're just being booted off.
Right.
That was common practice in the individual market for people with expensive conditions. Under the new law, no one will get a letter like that ever again.
I mean, what does the word insurance mean?
Yeah, nothing to the insurance companies. They cannot be turned down for insurance. The so-called cancellation letters waved around at that hearing were simply notices that policies would have to be upgraded or changed. Some of the old policies were so full of holes, they did not include hospitalization.
Oh, my gosh.
For instance. And here's one that they're going crazy about, maternity care. Like, all policies will have maternity care.
Yeah.
Including, like, one for me, including one for you. You have no intention of ever needing that, right?
Now, wait a minute. You can have maternity care?
No, but all policies, including those for men, will have, in order to have this cost, maternity care is expensive.
Yeah.
So then that, what that does is that spreads the cost around, and that's the whole deal.
Yeah, and I'm not going to have kids, and I don't mind sharing the wealth.
Yeah,
hey.
How about, do you mind paying school taxes? You don't
no.
have any kids, right?
No.
A lot of people in New York City don't drive. They have to pay road taxes. So this is the way things work.
I can give you a long list of what I do care about, but I think we all know what that is, starting with the war industry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I don't know what the hell you're going to say. let's see. A lot of them, if you had other serious conditions on these old plans, you...
It wasn't taken care of. Okay.
Republicans were apparently furious the government would dare intrude on an insurance company's freedom to offer a terrible product to desperate people. Can I read that again, dear friends? Republicans were furious that government would dare intrude on an insurance company's freedom to offer a terrible product to desperate people. Now, I think probably if you're listening to this show and you follow politics, you know this whack job from Minnesota, Michelle Bachmann, right? And much to the consternation of like Jon Stewart on The Daily Show and other comedians, she's retiring.
Because we've all had a good time with
her. But she
making fun of her, but she needs to go.
But there's someone stepping into the void. Her name's Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, and she said some people like to drive a Ford, not a Ferrari.
I read something about this woman the other day. Yeah.
And some people like to drink out of a red paper cup, not a crystal stem. You're taking away their choice.
Oh, please.
Yeah. I want to have. Ooh, don't say that word, Pete. I want to have a crappy policy. I demand to have a crappy hospitalization policy.
Says no one ever.
Let's go back to that other language. What's happening here is that what people have, so many people were paying money for, were a terrible product, and they did it because they were desperate people. They were desperate because they were poor. They wanted to have just some maybe fingernail hold on a policy that
some protection
that wouldn't ruin them financially if they got in an accident or they got sick or something like that.
And the insurance companies are getting away with, literally, I want to say murder. I mean, I know that sounds a little harsh, but they were getting away with, allowing these shoddy insurance policies to exist.
Yeah. This last thing that says, luckily, a comprehensive and affordable insurance policy is no longer a Ferrari. It is now a basic right. And, of course.
Well, yeah. And it's also a huge deal. I mean, my gosh, this is the first time that this country has ventured into this, arena. And of course, there are going to be issues. I didn't expect it to be. I just didn't know what to expect, honestly.
I didn't expect it would be this confusing.
Yeah, well, the website part for sure.
Yeah, right. Well, a number of people, young people, well, if you're 26 or under, you can be on your parents' policy if your parents have a policy. But
that was
people
a long time ago.
Like in their late 20s. I've heard people say, I can't afford another 80 or 90 bucks a month because I'm only making $18,000 a year.
Right.
And so many people, so many Americans, well, increasingly less, but increasingly less. Does that work?
Oh, that's increasingly fewer.
Yeah. Would, that's 85, 90 bucks. That's, like a meal, we were saying, Theater Bazaar.
Theater Bazaar. That occurs at the Masonic Temple.
Yeah, 65 bucks a ticket, something like that. But so everybody can't afford that. But millions of people will qualify for federal subsidies that will pay the entire monthly cost of some health care plans being offered in the online marketplaces set up under President Obama's health care law. A surprising figure that has not garnered much attention, in part because the zero premium plans come with serious trade-offs. So you do, they're very high deductibles. Like right now, a lot of young people, they're thinking, hey, I'm 28, I'm not going to get all those.
I'm fine,
and they're probably right. In fact, that's why they have to be enrolled to be fine and not draw on the overall
system.
And that'll be left to older people to do that. But these are bronze policies, the least expensive available. And the availability of these free premium plans shows that it's achieving its goals of making health care insurance widely available. has to do more. And in fact, one of the things I think is necessity is that people that support healthcare for all don't just give blanket approval to this. Well, I mean, we really have to demand that the insurance companies aren't the main beneficiaries of it, that the people are.
Absolutely.
And they will. I mean, that we're going to bring tens of millions of people in under that, for sure. You remember, I'm not even looking. Let's see.
Yeah, it's just going to take a little time. Just going to take a little time for that.
Yeah. Got a couple of people on waiting on the line, but let me. We've got one
in
of
fact,
our.
In fact, one of them is our friend AJ.
AJ,
we'll be with you in a minute.
Yeah, AJ, who had a wonderful cafe in fabulous Funky Ferndale.
Yeah, now he's moved. We'll let him tell us about
it. He can tell us. But actually, he's calling to tell us about a benefit event that's coming up on this coming Thursday.
Great.
Yeah, but let me just finish up a little with this. One of our. Loyal listeners is in Sweden. Scott. And let me see. This is a little long, but I think it's worth it. He writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He listens to the podcast. Wait, Scott, what are you doing, man? You could be, it's like morning drive. You know, it's like, you know, like we have here at WRIF, right? But anyway, at exactly 1 hour into the podcast, caller Ron from
last week's
show.
Yeah,
Ron from Shelby Township. You know that guy that calls in kind of frequently?
Yeah.
Ron, you're listening. If you're listening, you're about to get dissed out. He's either pulled a fast one, is as dumb as a sack of bent hinges, or more readily pounces on a dangled right wing BS than a golden retriever on a tennis ball.
I love his words.
Yeah, but it gets better. Now, I've listened to the podcast a couple of times to make sure I'm quoting Ron accurately. He lauds some flying monkey talk show called Joyce Riley and then claims that the amount spent on this health and health care is $653 million, and this amounts to $2 million per citizen.
And this is for the website alone.
Well, by the way, one of the things, this is what is allotted. This is not what has been spent. Somebody wrote in to tell me that. At this point, says Scott, in listening in Sweden, I sprayed coffee all over the room, was even more stunned that neither of you didn't drag that caller's sorry butt over to the door and kick his ass off the air with suitable cursing. I know I was cursing vehemently. I'm no math genius, but I did get an A in seventh grade math, and my nose can smell stinky figures, especially putrid ones. 2 million per U.S. citizen? He says, you asked explicitly for night call researchers to dig into this, so he did. He says, first, the actual cost of the website has been narrowed down and is only a fraction of the right-wing claim. Oh, the actual cost seems to be an expense of $125 million, which is about a sixth to a fourth of the wingnut claim.
Yeah.
Second, the U.S. population is 320 million. At 2 million per citizen, that would be $640 trillion.
Stinky math.
Yeah. Well, then he goes on. Let's see. Now here is an accurate transcript of what Ron said, and I encourage you to replay his word. I got that figure on Obama Healthcare website. It's $653 million, and I got that figure from Joyce Riley. It's documented. Yeah, you guys ought to listen to Joyce Riley. Everything she discloses on her shows, the guests she has on her shows, they have everything documented. This is all documented. So.
Isn't she the one? She's a conspiracy ish type.
Never heard of her.
I don't know.
Oh, remind me about boycottliberalism.com.
Okay.
All right, after this. So here's what Scott, listening in Sweden, says. What I'm requesting is that caller Ron of Shelby Township, if you're listening, do call up and explain to us all again just exactly how double plus good accurate this wingnut website radio program is supposed to be spreading such math buggery. Or if you can't explain why you presented such absurd, amphagoric poppycock as fact.
I thoroughly enjoyed this email.
Yeah. Perhaps you are prey to ideological enthusiasm and reflexively inflating the number just a wee tad, only by a factor of a million. Because if you do the math using your own highly inflated number, it's still just over $2 a citizen. And let's see, a proud member of Sweden, says Scott, the greatest nanny state of them all. Here everybody has comprehensive single-payer medical insurance costing a sliding scale percentage of one's income. In my family, it's about $500 a month. There's no insulting. Well, isn't that high? Let me see. That'd be six
grand. Well, it depends on how many people are.
Might have a lot of money.
There in the
is
family,
no,
Peter.
There is no insulting class division by gold, silver, bronze, tin, aluminum, foil, and cardboard cardboard insurance plan.
You need your own radio show.
I was going to say, everyone gets egalitarian, democratic, comprehensive coverage. Y'all should be so lucky to get on a real socialist health care plan and not the Heritage Institute's private insurance selfish scheme, which is piss.
All right. Oh, thank you for sending that.
Right. Okay.
And thank you for being one of our night call researchers.
Yes.
You're hired.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm reading Bill Ayers' latest memoir called Public Enemy.
And most people know him as William Ayers, also known as the one.
No.
Yeah,
Nobody knows him as William.
I think so. Don't they? Okay. Anyway.
Nobody.
So, well, I know you.
He's William Ayers, this respected educator and professor of education, but in his, what do they call it, his salad days? What the hell does that mean? Anyways, back in the 1960s and 70s, he was part of the Weather Underground that carried out about 22 bombings in which no one was ever hurt and certainly no one ever killed. But he and his wife, Bernadine Dorn, surrendered at some point, and because of a lot of reasons, she served a little time. He didn't serve any. And he went on to this distinguished career in education. He's around 70 or something now. But I didn't we knew somewhat that this, remember those people, John McCain, and remember, what was this woman's name? Monica Lewin? No, Sarah Palin. How soon we forget, unfortunately.
I wish I could forget more.
Yeah, but she brought up the idea that Barack Obama, because Barack Obama was from the Hyde Park area in Chicago, and so was Bill Ayers, and they were involved in these, not radical little deals, but it's joint sort of liberal community projects.
They called it community organizing, which...
No, that wasn't even that.
Okay.
It was just like community groups trying to help the community. And so then Sarah Palin said that Obama was
palling
around with an unrepentant terrorist, Bill Ayers. And so I always used to like to say, because I know Bill, and I used to say that I am proud to say that I didn't pal around with him then.
You were part of that organization.
I would like to pal, but I do pal around with him now. And this is an incredibly moving memoir called Public Enemy, and I'm going to get him back on the air. But I didn't realize how much, or maybe, I don't know, maybe he's inflating, but how much he figured in the 2008 election. That because his book came out, that's right, I'm skipping back too many years to his first book. In 2008, that he, because of Palin, started having all these speaking engagements canceled, and he was talking about education. He wasn't talking
because
about...
Because he was so highly demonized.
Yeah, he was completely demonized. He would come to campuses to talk at an education seminar, and he had to be surrounded by armed cops because, you know, these right-wingers were all there... claim of being good Americans are really these fascists who send threatening letters the story.
Well, yeah, death threats. All of that. Yeah. I mean, people were frothing.
Yeah, they were frothing. A fascist froth.
Yes.
But
that's a great name for a band.
One of the things that Bill said, one of the things that Bill in his book said, Bill Ayers, is that he was listed on this website called BoycottLiberalism.com. Now, you know that I usually don't like to give right-wingers any publicity because P.T. Barnum said any publicity is good publicity as long as they spell your name right. Here's why. You go to this site, and it is absolutely extraordinary because there are so many people on it. For one thing, he has the top 1,000 liberals in the United States. And I keep thinking, what am I, 1,001? It's probably like
chopped liver,
20,000,
chopped liberal.
Yeah, chopped. I like that. 20,000 other people on the left that are saying, "How come I'm not? I'm more liberal than him," you know. And so then they have liberal celebrities, liberal academics, and I'm thinking, man, my whole career, I didn't make it to this wing nuts. And there it was, liberal talk show host.
You were there?
Yeah, I was on that. But then
I don't know how I fly under the radar.
Well, I wrote them, and didn't I send you a copy of that? And I said that
you did.
I was disappointed at first that I didn't see my name there. But it disturbed me that my name didn't have an active link on it. Because so, I don't understand the mentality. It would you when you look at this site, go check it out, people, at boycottliberalism.com. It's got, and then it's on the right, it's got all this crazy Bible stuff and all that. You can tell where this guy's coming from. But
well, you made the list, Pierre. I'm proud of you.
I made the list, but it's it shows you the extent of, contrary to what sort of the popular perception is, that even liberals, let alone people to the left of that, are these isolated minorities that have no, that don't resonate in the public dialogue, which you see, I didn't know he was liberal.
I need to check out the list.
And I'd write him a letter, say, how come I'm not on there? I might co-host this show with Werby.
No, that's okay. Yeah. I don't need all that.
Yeah.
I'm just happy to be right here.
All right, let's get our pal AJ on the air. AJ, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, it's great to hear from both of you.
Yeah,
you're
well.
Doing great.
Thank you. Hi, AJ. AJ O'Neill. What's that?
Hey, Julie. Good to hear from you.
Hey, good to talk to you.
Now, AJ had a wonderful, wonderful coffee house in downtown, like old-fashioned coffee house. Great coffee, always terrific entertainment there.
He has his own brand of coffee.
Now you have your own brand of coffee, right? This will sound like one of those things those national talk show hosts do. But
it's true.
It's true. We're not getting paid for this. But are you still roasting?
Yeah, when I left the cafe, I was kind of like a fish out of water. I didn't really know what I was going to do. And I thought, well, the glue that kind of held all that together, besides the great community activists and the roles that we were able to do with the coffee. So I thought, well, people said, keep it going. And since it's roasted in Highland Park and it's part of the greater story of what we're all about here in Detroit, been roasted there since 1913, and I said, I'm going to go out there and continue to maybe get the message out on the back of a bag of coffee, and that's what I'm doing.
Hey, that's very like cool. You're like what, Dr. Broner's soap?
Sort of, yeah. It's called Detroit Bold, and on the back of it, it kind of talks about Detroit having that can-do spirit, the grit, the determination, and everything that we've all been talking about for so many years, what lies just underneath the layer of what Detroit is a hardworking group of people who just got that can-do spirit. And I want to give them a good cup of coffee to maybe get that conversation going with. So.
And I know we're going to talk about...
You're calling about this benefit though,
but
right?
I want to say that AJ did something really, really cool, because how we've talked about how the streetlights were turned off in Highland Park?
Right.
He put together this fundraiser to start putting solar streetlights, and you've succeeded.
Yeah, we actually did a blend called Solar Blend, and we did a Kickstarter campaign, raised over $6,000. And put what I believe is Michigan's first urban solar streetlight right back in Highland Park, where it all began anyway. So,
what a good idea.
Yeah, it's off the grid completely. It's owned by the community. It runs like clockwork every night. Never a bill. And
those streetlights, they're always high enough that they're going to get sun. Why don't they do that? But listen, I'm looking at the clock, and we're up against some commercials in just a little while. But you're calling about this benefit on Thursday, aren't you?
Yeah, I would really thank you so much for allowing us to tell you about Cass Park. It's called Sundays in Cass Park every other Sunday. Just a bunch of people that you and I both know run around town. We realize that, heck, these people that have lost their jobs that are still trying to make it in Detroit, a lot of them are hungry.
Sure.
So, I was going downtown. I ran into Al Bencich, and he was on his motorcycle. I said, where are you going? He said, follow me. We ended up in Cass Park. I saw a group of people just helping out feeding the homeless, and it's a potluck. A guy named Jim Realberg, he's been kind of putting it together, the glue really behind it all, and he's been footing the bill for this stuff. We feed sometimes upwards of 200 people every other week, and really do it out of cash out of hand and potluck style. So,
food. I've seen the photos. Oh my gosh, yeah. You guys are really doing a great job.
And Cass Park is right in front of the Masonic Temple. People probably see that when they go down there for events. So there's going to be a benefit this Thursday. There's something called the Wobbly Kitchen, which sounds like, whoa, that's the kind of shaky. But Wobbly is the nickname for an old radical union, the Industrial Workers of the World. You can go to IWW.org and still going, still recruiting people, still organizing workers. And so tell us about the venue. Tell us how people can show up. I'm going to show up.
Thank you. Yeah, we're going to have some great food. We're going to have actually the old recipe, the old spaghetti recipe from that the Wobblies made for the striking newspaper workers back in the 90s, I believe.
Wow.
So, you know, we're still, they're still there. They're proud. This is under a different, you know, different background, but really it's all integrated. It's going to be at the Gaelic League on Michigan Avenue. If anybody wants to know, you know, go to the old Facebook standby. Cass Park Sundays for the Friends and Forgotten Worker fundraiser. It's Thursday night from 6:30 to 10. Suggested donation is $15, but we won't turn anybody away. There's going to be a tin can raffle. We've got some great things in there. You know, and we want to fill a hat or two up so that we can continue to, you know, feed people every other Sunday. Today it was pretty blustery out there, but we've never missed a Sunday. And since Father's Day of 2011, it's been going.
That's great.
That
and you know,
so
AJ,
cool.
People can find out this. I used to try to keep up with things on my calendar at Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, but I found it almost impossible. Fortunately, now there's a community calendar of events in our whole area called Detroit.ActiveHub.org, or you can go to my website and link onto it, and it'll give you all the details about. And it's this Thursday, the 14th, at the Gaelic League.
Which is Gaelic.
Yes, thank you. And there just may be some Irish beer down there too. Huh?
I think so.
I'm thinking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great spaghetti, great company, great music. We've got some great bands, Cello Bella. Just a lot of good hometown folky music, folks from that used to play at AJ's that play at coffee houses and bars all over town. It's going to be just a good old-fashioned hootenanny potluck. Let's pass a hat around and try to help some people that could really use it.
All right, AJ, you're great. Thank you
so
much.
Such great work, AJ.
Well, you guys, really looking forward to seeing you. Sounds great.
I'll be down there. All right. Yeah.
Thursday night,
yeah. The Gaelic League.
And you know,
Detroit.
The thing about the Sundays in Cass, you never see me there because I am on the air every day, every Sunday at that time. So, and I never want to ask for time off, but I would love to go down there and help out sometime. So.
All right. Jake, may remember him from last week. He wrote in, he said, guns make us safe. We'll talk a little about that when we come back.
Mm-hmm.
Your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night call.
My mum always says hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice as usual. So we worked very hard to make Geico.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at Geico.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit Geico.com today. Oh, and Mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash behind my ears this morning.
You can always tell how good a football team is by their starting lineup. The same goes for Buffalo Wild Wings, like our legendary Hall of Fame starter, the 82 Pepperoni Pockets, the hunger-crushing Pub Burger, loaded with bacon and beer cheese, the Stampede Burger, packed with a fiery kickoff of jalapenos, our beefy Reuben Burger, and of course, our star quarterback, the Hail Mary Burger, coated with our very own spicy Bloody Mary ketchup. Now, who can compete with that roster?
Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
What you're supposed to do to take care of your tires by Mike Rowe. You know, I don't really know what you're supposed to do. You know who does, though? The tire experts in the service department at your Ford dealership.
Get up to $140 in mail-in rebates on 4 select tires when you use the Ford Service Credit Card. Click on the banner now. Subject to credit approval, rebates by check. Other tire manufacturer rebate or offer cannot be combined or Ford Service Credit Card rebate or offer. See your participating Ford dealer for rebate details through 12/31/13.
All around us. No wonder it's hard to imagine we're facing a water crisis. but we are. So that's why the American Planning Association brings you simple ways to save water at home and in your community. Learn more at planning.org. That's planning.org. A public service message from this station and the American Planning Association.
You know how in spy movies the hero always has high-tech gadgets that help him save the day? Like x-ray glasses or a grappling hook wristwatch. Well, now the eSurance mobile app lets you save the day if you're ever in an accident. Only instead of scaling walls, you can start a claim, upload a few photos, and get your money fast. That's way cooler than an exploding pen. eSurance. Insurance for the modern world. Now back by Allstate. Click or call.
Visit eSurance.com or call 1-800-ESURANCE for a quote. Not available in all states or for all claims. Allstate products are not available through eSurance.
101 WRIF.
We take you to the next level, will ya?
The Riff. The Riff.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
Hi, thank you very much. And before we heard from AJ about this benefit to feed hungry people in Cass Park, and you know, two things strike me about that, Jolene. First thing, of course, is the open-heartedness, the good-heartedness of people that don't need to do this, that have their own source of food, but feel an ethical, a moral, and some cases even religious drive to help people less fortunate.
Yeah.
The other thing is, why in the richest country in the world are there 200 people showing up for a free feeding? Because I suspect that there are not too many of you listening that will say, oh, good, I can go down to Cass Park in front of the Masonic Temple and get a free dinner. Because even the poorest among you probably listening have your own source of food, although it may be the poorest among you, it may be threatened to some extent, which we'll talk in a little while. So it's because the poorest among us are not, well, that'd be listening, but the poorer than the poorest listening don't have radios probably even to listen to.
True.
All right. More with Guns Make Us Safe. This has been a murderous week.
Another murderous week.
Yeah. Well,
this is a bad one.
Something like 17 people, was it killed in the last 10 weeks or 10, or I'm sorry, days? That barbershop
Detroit.
Shooting. Yeah.
Yeah. There was the young woman who in the back of the head.
Let's get it. This happened in Dearborn Heights. This is predominantly a so-called white district. Although I think I said the other, maybe last show or something like that, our friend Frank Joyce, who was a guest on the show, said, why are there predominantly black cities and predominantly white cities? How did this all occur? We take it for granted.
Some people would call up and say, well, it was Coleman Young, right?
Yeah, I would say that it's the economy. Anyway, 4 days ago, after a young woman was found dead outside a Dearborn Heights home at which she is believed to have sought help after a car accident, the family is asking, why did she have to die? Little has been publicly released about the circumstances of Renisha McBride's death on Saturday. The 19-year-old from Detroit died of a shotgun blast to the head outside the home on Outer Drive near Warren Avenue. Dearborn Heights police said they have, quote, identified the person who fired the shot and killed the woman. Well, that's nice. It was his house.
They haven't said this guy's name or anything.
Well, here, 4 days after the young woman was found dead, they're talking about issuing some sort of warrant against the guy. This is like George Zimmerman.
I agree.
Yeah, exactly. And I wonder what would have happened, and we raised this at the time. We never will know what happened in the Zimmerman-Trayvon Martin confrontation because George Zimmerman killed the only other witness. But I said at the time, what would have happened if Trayvon Martin would have killed George Zimmerman, would have felt this guy grabbed him and saw that he had a gun? I'm not saying this is even what happened, and fearfully started smashing George Zimmerman's head into the ground, and he killed him. And he said, I'm standing my ground. I was fearing for my life because this man with a gun came out of nowhere, confronted me, and started asking me, what are you doing around here? With all the implications that any black person in America knows what that's all about.
What are you doing about. In our neighborhood?
Do you think Trayvon Martin would have been able to go home for the number of days? I can't even remember what it was, but it was quite a long time.
Before being arrested?
Before being arrested.
Or even questioned.
Or do you think now that the big case would have been defend Trayvon Martin for the charges of first-degree murder that would have been brought against him. But anyway, so this, and, you know, we don't know all of the circumstances here. So this could turn out to be something different. But let's go at it what we said. This is a 19-year-old girl who was killed by a shotgun blast to the head. And where did you see that it was to the back of the head? I didn't see
it
that.
It was someone who works here. You know, I think he saw it on the news.
Okay. Her cell phone dead, her family said she made her way to the house for help after the early morning accident. She had run into a car. Police have refused to release details of their investigation. Well, let's see what would have happened if it would have been the other way around, that this unidentified man in Dearborn Heights would have gone into the city of Detroit. Let's assume he's white. We might find out a lot of different things. But I'm going to make the assumption that he's white. He goes to an inner-city home, and he knocks on the door, and someone answers it with a shotgun blast.
Right.
Do you think there would be 4 days before the person that killed this hapless?
I don't even think it'd be
four minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Police on Wednesday asked the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office to issue a warrant for the resident in the fatal shooting. But late Wednesday, the office said it sent back the request. Now, Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy is she's no slouch, so there might be some interesting things going on
here. She's on it.
Yeah. Who is this now? Family members said they believe that the niece was racially profiled. Now, the lawyer for the Dearborn Heights homeowner was in fear for his life.
The lawyer is, or the homeowner?
The homeowner, that's what the lawyer says.
Oh.
Was a justified shooting. And Cheryl Carpenter from Bloomfield Hills said, I'm confident when the evidence comes, it will show that my client was justified and acted as a reasonable person would who was in fear for his life.
Well, of course, the attorney's going to say that.
I mean, but one of the things, I guess, you open the door, with a shotgun. Yeah.
Yeah, the only thing we know about this guy is he's 54 years old.
Yeah.
That's it.
One local defense attorney, attorney Arnold Reed, said some of the factors that will determine whether the shooting the woman was justifiable are whether she was armed, whether she was in the home, and how far away she was from the shooter when she was wounded. All of these factors will make it a little tough for the homeowner to argue self-defense. And all of these, gun things just continue. An 88-year-old man set fire to his house, then fatally shot a volunteer reserve police officer. This policeman, this is kind of a different deal. Chicago prosecutors have announced that police officer Gildardo Serrera will not face any criminal charges in the June 2011 killing of Flint Farmer, even though video footage shows Farmer armed only with a cell phone. Armed? How can he be armed with a cell phone?
Right.
Lie bleeding on the ground as Sierra fired 16 times. Mm. This is a cop shooting a guy 16 times, hitting Farmer 7 times, including 3 bullets in the back. This was Sierra's third shooting, his second fatal one in 6 months. He later admitted to drinking multiple beers before going to work. Police waited over 5 hours to give him a breathalyzer, and the city paid $4.1 million settlement in a lawsuit brought by Farmer's family.
Yeah, and he has no charges, none whatsoever.
And he's still on the force.
God, that's something so
but
wrong
they,
with
they
that.
They took away his gun.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
He took away his gun.
Well.
And this goes on. A young man, a powerful weapon, a crowded public space. Those are the hallmarks of the now grimly familiar routine of mass shootings in the United States. But Richard Shoup walked into the Garden State Plaza with a modified AK-47 assault rifle. He was wearing a black motorcycle helmet and clad in black. Fortunately, he fired shots in the air. There was chaos and confusion. And terrified shoppers fled or hid in closets, office, and bathrooms. And fortunately, can you imagine having to save this? He shot himself.
I know. They found him way back in some construction area at 3:30 in the morning.
Wow. And
it started at 9.
And I don't know, it was just a party in Houston. I mean, you know, this country has gone mad. And one of the things that Jake, who has written in, thoughtful letter, it's an 18-year-old defender of the Second Amendment, said that almost all people that possess weapons are sane. They're not mass murderers. Yeah, but the operative word there is almost.
Yeah.
And when you look
at the percentage of the numbers of people who have guns.
Yeah, one-tenth of one. Yeah, because there's so many people, you got to think that a lot of nutballs are going to wind up with them.
Yeah.
But that's what's creating this epidemic of violence. You know, we were talking about the health care plan earlier, and someone calling themselves Yosarian, that's a name from Catch-22. Most people know that sort of the phrase, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. But it's a book by Joseph Heller. He said, and he asked, how can a website for Obamacare cost more than $100 million? People just report those numbers matter-of-factly without the slightest indication of surprise or incredulity. Actually, I've heard it reported rather casually, costing as much as $600 million. Well, it doesn't. It costs about $125 to $150 million. And you can say, wait a minute.
But there's a bunch of people on the payroll.
Give me $500 and I'll create a website.
Right.
Yeah, right.
For an entire country of people who are trying to get insurance.
and that is all the costs of it, and that includes all the employees that are answering the phones and all of that. So that's what's going on. Is it more than should have been? I don't know. Let's get Scott from Westland on the air. Scott, hi, you're on the air. Welcome. Was that you texting us?
Yes. So I wanted to bring up the subject I had 2 weeks ago, but I have an alternate topic if that's not okay. I guess I don't have to be so specific about it. The main thing is that a lot of companies, and there's actually, as I've heard, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of lawsuits like this from various companies of various sizes, which are seeking an exemption under Obamacare from providing contraception to their workers.
Right.
And so it's some people that we've heard of before, actually, and do you mind if I mention the one company?
Yeah, go ahead.
This was reported on other news outlets.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, Eden Foods, I guess.
That's E-D-E-N, not E-A-T-I-N. Eden Foods. Eden Foods, go ahead.
They're a pretty long-lived organic food company based in Clinton, Michigan, and I just would have to say that, of course, our old friend Tom Monahan, who was the founder of Domino's, also has a similar lawsuit, but again, these people are not alone in this. But that was just the reason why I found that ironic. If I was Rush Limbaugh, I might say try processing that through your liberal agenda, because basically I'm not a vegetarian, but I'm for organic foods, and I actually have bought stuff from this company. So I have to admit I'm very conflicted about this, and I'm actually...
Well, wait. What I understand, Monahan, who's this right-wing Catholic, very religious, and has contributed hundreds of millions of dollars to... foster right-wing Catholic views. Why is Eden Food not want to give contraception to their employees?
I don't know any of them well enough to know what their religious beliefs are, but I guess apparently that it's got something to do with their religion. The one other thing I wanted to mention about Obamacare that I think has been getting confused in the media is that I think that the actual cost of a health plan under Obamacare is not just the premium that you get, but it's the premium minus the subsidy, because I think that some of the reports of people getting their health care plan canceled and then going onto the website and then discovering that they have to pay more, do they realize they might be eligible for a subsidy and their actual cost is the premium minus the subsidy?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, some of these right-wing creatures that inhabit television and radio have been trotting out these people that say, you know, I was only paying $200 a month, and now I'm going to have to pay $600 a month. And some of these liberal groups have been tracking these people down and discovering that most of them are going to wind up with better policies, as you said, Scott, with better coverage, less money, and conform to the law. All right. Thank you very much for bringing that up. Maybe anybody know anything about this Eden Foods? I thought they were.
No, now I'm curious.
Yeah. Last Tuesday, by the way, was Election Day. And as usual, the big story was that, you know, hardly anybody voted.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, Low numbers.
I just met.
We have a new mayor in Detroit.
I met a woman from Australia. And she was telling me that in Australia, it's illegal not to vote.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's a legal requirement that you must vote. Although, what was the phrase she used? A something ballot. But people go in there and write on the ballot, I won't vote. You know, but you literally, I mean, that's a little scary.
I never knew that.
Yeah, and we've been told all our lives that we live in a democratic society, that that full participation of everyone is necessary. But first off, they don't make it that easy. As we've said for years, Jalene, that if they would make Election Day a holiday.
Yes.
Why? I mean, I don't know why the Dems don't do that.
Don't push for that.
Yeah.
Well, they're too busy with other things.
Well, whatever. Why they haven't done it for the last 50 years.
I agree.
Because
wholeheartedly.
It's even harder for working people and poor people if they're working, to get off, to get the time off.
Yeah.
And you can imagine going to have to work at 7, you get off at 5:30 or 6.
The last thing you want to do is go stand in this long line, and then some people need to get home and feed their kids, pick up their kids, take their kids wherever they got to go. Sometimes it's almost impossible. And then people who live in poverty oftentimes can't get there.
Yeah, and sometimes they're just poverty just kind of erodes, will. I mean, it engenders a passivity. And so one of the arguments, though, about having another holiday, they'll say, oh, that'll mean, you know, generating, what's the thing, you know, sort of, if you get a day off, you're hurting the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So have another weekend, Saturday or Sunday. You're going to have 2 days of voting. Why? What's wrong with that? Anybody think that that's a bad idea?
I could think of a few holidays we could swap it out with. But I'm not going to say it.
Not Christmas. Okay.
Not going to say.
All right. 248-544-WRIF. And you can text us at 4WRIF, 49743. Now, there was a number of ballot issues. Oh, there were some good things, by the way. The billionaire Koch brothers who try to finance everything horrid and right wing, they got rebuffed pretty much everywhere. They have a new strategy.
Now explain that.
Well,
in what way?
They were putting lots of money into small towns trying to
Get the tea partiers in
there. Yeah. And in fact, because that's what the tea baggers now are doing, because they're getting rebuffed at the level of the Republican Party establishment, because the fat cats.
They think they're nuts.
Yeah, they don't care whether they're nuts. They care that they're losing them elections.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The big capitalists have always used the fascists historically. Most of the history of fascism has been in Europe, but in the 1930s, the big capitalists said, "Yeah, good. Hitler will take care of our opponents on the left."
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, they see, the Koch brothers and the other billionaires see that the Tea Party, the teabaggers, are getting pushed to the margins by the party establishment, so they're going to start going after the local offices, school boards, county commissioners.
These guys aren't going to stop for anything or anyone.
Yeah, and they've got endless money. And the only thing I don't realize, that I don't always wonder, understand, thank you, is why these baggers don't realize what tools they are for the ultra-wealthy.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're just blinded.
Here's some of the things that went down.
Some really cool stuff happened.
You want to start with the cool stuff or the bad stuff?
Let's start with the cool stuff. No, let's do the bad stuff, and then let's come back at the top of the hour and do the good stuff.
All right.
Because we only have a couple minutes, right?
Yeah. In Washington State, food safety advocates pushed this measure that would have made GMO, genetically modified organism food, be labeled. And it should be labeled as such for retail purposes in the state. And it lost pretty bad, 45%, yeah.
55% voting against the initiative, 45%
right. For it. Yeah. And these big companies and all, you know, Monsanto and all this. Let me see who I'm trying to see.
They're colossal.
Yeah. In Washington State, the Grocery Manufacturers Association spent about $11 million donated by food companies that include PepsiCo, Hormel, Bumblebee, meaning that the food industry collectively contributed even more to defeat the labeling effort than did Monsanto, which sells genetically engineered seeds. And there was a lot. I thought there was a list of these companies, these big chemical companies. So I don't understand. So, I mean, it ought to just tell you. Well, one of the things that their argument was it was going to make food cost more because they were going to have to print labels or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's always one of the arguments against, like, a minimum wage increase and what have you, that it's going to cost more. And so they got to put little things on there like saying, and you can't charge the people for what you should be doing anyway. Why should the consumer have to eat the cost of full information about what food products that we're consuming?
Right. Well, these corporations would like to keep everyone in the dark.
That's
and
right.
Continue business as usual.
Stephen Colbert had this thing. I was watching this little thing that he was talking about. He said, you know, why should we? We don't have any right to know what's being put inside of us.
Yeah. I love him.
All right. Also, another loss, a tar sand showdown in South Portland, Maine. Environmentalists faced off with the fossil fuel industry in the small coastal town of South Portland. Well, listen to that. Environmentalists faced off with the fossil fuel industry. Who do you think won here?
Fossil fuel.
Yeah. At issue is the Waterfront Protection Ordinance, a land use zoning ordinance was up for referendum on Tuesday that would prevent oil industry efforts to build a massive tar sands export facility, and it lost 51% to 49%. So 51% of people in South Portland think that's just fine to have a massive tar sands export facility there.
Yeah, they clearly don't understand the toxicity involved here.
Well, maybe, just maybe, they wanted jobs. You know, is it going to poison us? You know, there's a town in Quebec I may have mentioned before called Asbestos, Quebec.
Oh, yeah.
So this will be, they'll change their name from South Portland, nice city, Portland, beautiful little city in Maine, they can call it Tar Sands, Maine.
Yet, there's something to do with the marijuana in Portland, Maine.
Okay, we'll talk about that when we come back.
And
thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Riv. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call.
This next song goes out to someone real special, web developers. You've developed a world wide web of convenience, and Geico.com is eternally grateful. Now everyone can pay bills, manage policies, maybe save big money on car insurance, all from the comfort of their desk chairs, recliners, and water beds. You're magicians with wands made of binary code, and that's why we're sending this next song out to you. For a free rate quote, visit Geico.com.
Hey, music lovers. Tired of your music buffering while you're running around? Here's a reality check. Verizon's 4G LTE is the most reliable and in more places than any other 4G network. Reliability you can believe in. That's powerful. Verizon. Click on the banner to compare the maps.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. Honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes or if the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
Game on. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Everything that rocks.
Peter and Jolene. You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, we're back, and it almost does it for all our commercials, so we'd like you to participate at 248-544-WRIF.
And that's 248-544-9743.
You okay?
I'm great.
That's good. That's
you put
good.
Me into a food coma with that dinner you made.
I did. We had a good time. And, oh, by the way, if you'd like to see a little bit of our vanity, I was looking. I was looking at all the photographs of us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/nightcall.
Yeah?
And you know what are my favorites?
What?
You and I down to those demonstrations.
Yeah.
Throwing power, you know? Those are good.
Oh,
those are good. We're always that. Happiest. I love a parade.
Me too.
You go to my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Lots of stuff there as well. Always tell you what guests I'm going to have at 1 a.m. And if I can either remember or, oh, yeah, actually, it is the editor of the Progressive magazine talking about Howard Zinn, the late Howard Zinn, the historian whose mm-hmm. book, A People's History of the United States, I always, you know, someone said, give me one book to read. I don't know anything about politics. I don't know anything about history. How do I get in on
yeah,
it all? How do, where do
book.
I start?
That's the go-to.
Right there. And it's certainly not boring. That's
no,
for sure.
No, it's not at all. And it's the real story. It's why they call it A People's History.
Yeah, it's not the great men, the generals, the president. I don't even understand it. They're naming battleships after Gerald Ford.
Yeah, I saw that.
Or an aircraft carrier, wasn't it?
Some
billion
some
dollar
large ship.
Yeah, like that. We're not supposed to have kings and saints. We're supposed to have representatives of the people. So why do they get this adulation? Why do they have airports named after them? Why do they have these nutball Republicans that want to name something after Ronald Reagan, one of the most criminal presidencies in the 20th century, let's say. There's a lot going on back in the 19th century, who was involved in all his law-breaking, and his Reaganomics is what sunk the American economy. And these guys want to have something named after him in every single county in the United States. Let's say he was the greatest president ever. Why do
Still.
We... There's something undemocratic, and I mean small d. There's something that's out of keep... pardon me, out of keeping... She's saying, is he going to get his voice back?
Get it back.
There you go. There's something out of keeping with the American democratic spirit that to raise individual politicians to the level of sainthood or royalty.
Or just, it's like celebrity in a sense, too.
Yeah, there's something, maybe George Washington. I mean, that was a long time ago, or what Abraham Lincoln did. But when you start to get into fairly modern times, the last 100 years, man, red carpets and all that for people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, these inauguration balls are out of control. I don't care who wins. And I just wanted to say, Eric and Roseville, hang on.
Okay, we'll get you in just a sec. But anyway, let's get back to Howard Zinn. So I'm going to be interviewing the editor of the Progressive magazine talking about Howard Zinn. But there was this controversy over the summer when Mitch Daniels, who was the Indiana government and now is the president of Purdue University, tried to censor Howard Zinn's classic A People's History of the United States from Indiana classrooms. And so,
I read that, I didn't even realize that Zinn's book made it into classrooms because they have all these BS history books.
Well, in college, a professor can, sometimes they have required. But then just the other day, they had a Zinn read-in. They had a Zinn read-in committee. Envisions this event to be a commemoration of academic freedom and a declaration of anti-censorship. So they had this reading of Howard Zinn's book, and it was
love it.
Yeah,
and he now passed. It's been a few years now since he passed away, right?
Yeah, and his book. Usually there is a if they're required. I mean, if you sell 100,000 textbooks, you're just probably wealthy for the rest of your life. A People's History of the United States, last I heard, and this was a couple years ago, had sold 3 million copies.
Yeah.
Of this. So this is like an all-time bestseller.
Oh, it's wonderful. So, highly recommend adding it to your collection. It will change your life.
And we're talking about elections, and like Mike Duggan got in.
Duggan.
Yeah. What did I say?
Well, you just kind of.
Oh, yeah. As the mayor of Detroit, and there's a lot made of the fact that he's the first white mayor of Detroit in 40 years. And it occurs to me that African-American citizens of Detroit are willing to do something that white citizens would never do, the opposite of.
Right. But at the same time, you know, I've talked to several of my African-American friends who, you know, they say the old school African-American people in Detroit don't want a white mayor. Still, to this day.
Well.
I had this conversation this morning.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, you know, because I was saying this, what you said.
Okay. Well, the new school predominated, fortunately.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Here is Eric, and Eric is in Roseville. Eric, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I noticed you referred to a right-wing creature talk show host. Well, last week, one of them was literally laughing on the phone at Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who is so ignorant, she pronounced M-I-S-L-E-D, misled, and I thought, perfect symbol of the low-information voter, the stupid, I call him, who elected that empty suit into the White House. And I find it
very... Well, I mean, this kind of talk is reserved for the talk show host. Give me something of some substance rather than just insults. We'll take care of the insults.
What, not insults.
Debbie Wasserman is a congresswoman from Florida and head of some of the reelection campaign. Why do you think Obama's an empty suit?
He's an empty suit. Because, first of all, the idea of him being a law professor is a joke. If he was anything, he was probably the equivalent of a substitute teacher. They paid him to go in there and sit in there when the regular professor didn't show up.
So
what?
I've never heard this, but regardless of that, he's the president of the United States. Why is he an empty suit as the president of the United States?
Because he is nothing but a total... liar. He makes Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter look like total statesmen. But
why is he a total? What has he lied about?
Totally lied. What's been in the news for the last, 2 weeks?
You know, I don't know that exactly is a lie. I mean,
I think he's trying to figure it all out.
Yeah, it was a mistake without realizing. I mean, I think that that he meant what he said when he did it, that people weren't going to lose their health insurance, that people could keep their health insurance. But what he apparently didn't realize and never should have made such a categorical statement, and that's why he said that he had to apologize for that, was that these were substandard policies, which are essentially ripoffs of the people that were that had bought them, and that now that they would have to be replaced with adequate insurance policies. So, but if you want to call it a lie, all right, that's a lie. What's the other lie? What's lie number two?
Well, the other lie is a massive basic policy of his where he denies he knows anything about anything. He didn't know about the IRS thing. He didn't know about Benghazi. He knows nothing. Here's something real good.
Sure.
It was about a year ago, I think, when he said now that he was done with the Middle East, he was going to pivot to Asia. Yeah, now that he turned the Middle East into a total fireball, he's going to go destroy Asia.
I think it was maybe a guy called George W. Bush who did that.
Yeah, don't you think that was Bush? But you know one thing that...
Let him answer that. Don't you think it was Bush?
Don't you think Bush lit the fire?
Didn't he start it?
Oh, yeah, 5 years later, we're still blaming George Bush.
Yes, we are.
I'm still blaming...
He started it.
I'm still blaming Ronald Reagan for sinking our economy. And that was that Reaganomics started 25, 30 years ago. I mean, you know, things have consequences. But, you know, you'll get your chance to... there'll be some right-wing creature that will pop up in 2016. But are you ready for President Clinton?
Yeah, I don't think he... We're talking about Hillary.
Hillary.
Hillary will be a dream compared to what we have now.
Okay, good. She can put that on her endorsement.
She's going to be the... I'm sorry, I hate to tell you this, but it's going to be a lot the same if she gets in.
All right.
And except she won't be a black man. There you go.
Yeah, yeah. So that'll
make you feel a little bit better.
That'll satisfy a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, we were talking about the bad thing, one of the things that happened in the election, and but there were a number of good things for people that that realized that millions of people have had their life ruined because they wanted to smoke flowers and alter their consciousness just a little bit. Now, Michigan leading the way. Lansing, Jackson, and Ferndale amended their city charters to legalize the use of possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana on private property by anyone 21 years or older. Portland, Maine, a similar measure, there's some dopers, would allow for legal possession up to 2.5 ounces.
I never knew that. I always thought, you know, Portland, Oregon, of course, it's full of hippies. Portland, Maine, I didn't realize it was...
And it won big. In Portland, Maine, it won 67-33%. In Lansing, 63-37%. Jackson, 60-40%. In Funky Ferndale, 69%-31%. And the race to succeed billionaire Mayor Bloomberg in New York City pitted Democrat Bill de Blasio, who is this self-professed progressive, against this right-wing Republican, Joe, I don't know how you say his name, Yoda, maybe. Isn't that a character in Lord of the Rings or something like that?
But Yoda was Star Wars.
Was it? I don't know. Anyway, the progressive one, are you ready for this? 73% to 24%.
Wow.
They've had enough of Bloomberg and... what's the guy before him?
Was it Ed Koch?
No. You know, the guy that was during 9/11. He had an Italian last name? Giuliani.
Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah, yeah. Bad news for Vipers, though.
I kind of forgot about him. How did that happen?
Yeah. Bad news for Vipers. Vipers, you know what a Viper is?
I know it's a car.
Is it? It is. That's right. No, Vipers is like a 1930s term for a marijuana smoker.
It is?
Yeah, yeah. There's even some there's even some of these old songs that say that someone researched that for.
I think there's some
there's a song called I'm a Viper.
Okay. Yeah, I think there's some smoking utensils that go
Is that right? Okay.
Is that the word?
Anyways, anyway, I was corrected on that. It's not plural, it's singular. Marijuana has been legal in Colorado for a year, and a new measure now puts a 15% excise tax and 10% sales tax on the product. So you're going to have to be paying 25%. Yeah, it's like gasoline. And that passed by 65%. Now, fracking, which is this deal where these companies force water and chemicals down into the ground and then produce either tar sands gas, oil, or usually natural gas. And environmentalists are saying this is a disaster.
Well, it is a disaster.
Yeah.
What about it?
The three towns in Colorado have, and they were pitted again against big energy, and the people won.
Oh, this is so good to hear.
Boulder, California, Colorado, naturally. 77% said no more fracking. It lost in one little town, Fort Collins. It won by 55%, and Lafayette 58%. So,
well, you know, little large victories, I guess. You know, large for the people who live there, and one little victory at a time.
You know, here's what I'm going to stop doing. Defending Obama is a dirty job, and I'm not going to do it. If somebody else wants to do it, you can do it, because here's somebody else.
Well, maybe you don't know what he's going to say.
Well, Ken says it's Obama's. Oh yeah, all right, okay. Let's see. Let's get Ken on the air.
It's Kevin.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah. Kevin, are you with us? Go ahead, Kevin. You're on the air.
Yeah. I just wanted to expand on Mr. Obama's lies. Clearly, the previous caller that was indicting him as a liar was a Republican, and
you think?
It's kind of hard for a Republican to do. I am not a Republican, nor am I a Democrat. I refer to them as Republicrats and Democans. because they are the same thing. And anyways, I want to talk about Obama's campaign promises to end the Patriot Act, to bring an end to the war on terror, to expand civil liberties, to decriminalize marijuana.
I don't know if he said all of it.
I don't remember.
You're thinking about Ron Paul, I think.
No. I mean, Obama had a small, like on his website, you could go to a part where it wasn't decriminalizing, but it was reducing the charges, reducing the punishment, and reducing the enforcement of marijuana. And also eliminate, I don't know, he had something about the spying program. All of which he has done the complete opposite of. I don't know if he's expanded the drug laws, but.
No.
I mean, he vowed to, veto the 2012 NDAA Act if it got through Congress, which he signed.
This was the big defense act. Yeah. Yeah.
Right, which allows the.
Well, let me ask you a question. Are you shocked? If you are,
that
I'm
any
shocked.
Politician
I'm
made
shocked
promises
that you're
that they
shocked.
Didn't follow through with.
This is literally, to me, I mean, I think there was something important about defeating McCain and Palin and certainly Romney and Ryan. But did I or did Jolene or more of us think that, gee, this was going to really usher in this progressive era and that this was going to be a politician that wasn't going to function like an imperial president?
Yeah.
For one thing, he's constrained by a lot of things, not the least of which the Republicans want to make sure that he never gets to do anything. And some of the things that you said, like, for instance, they just the Senate just passed this bill that would outlaw discrimination based on sexual preference. So that's good, but do you think that's going to get through the House of Representatives dominated by the Republicans? I doubt it.
But it's not about what he hasn't been able to do. It's what he has done.
Well, you're right.
He didn't have to sign the NDAA Act, which allows for the indefinite detention of any person in the world, including American citizens, without any form of due process. He was not forced to do that. The Congress did not make him do that. No, I think it passed Congress like a 93-7 vote. Well, so that just shows that we live under a criminal government.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you about that because, yeah, I was going to say that this political consensus on these tyrannical laws like the Patriot Act, like the one you just mentioned. I can't remember the name of it. I can't remember the what are the initials again?
The NDAA Act.
The NDAA, yeah. The
National Defense
Authorization Act, right. That's going to go in no matter who is the president, no matter what party is running it. There's going to be an imperial war president until there's this fundamental change in how we look at foreign policy. As long as, you know, we still have bases all around the world, as long as we still have Africa commands and South American commands, in other words, that we think we have to control the entire world, we're going to keep having enemies. We're going to that the military is going to be a self-justification. In other words, we're going to have to find enemies like we did after World War II. We're going to invent them, even if they don't exist, in order to maintain a military-industrial complex. That's going to continue whether there's Democrats or Republicans. But if you don't think there's any difference of the way, you know, women would fare, even, not that Obama's been great on any of the issues having to do with labor or the middle class or poor people, under these tools of the billionaires, I mean, things would be a lot worse.
I mean, it's just a different track to the same. It's just a different path to the same result.
Well, I don't think if you've got people that...
There's going to be a varying of result there.
Yeah. I mean, we should not be satisfied with the Democratic Party. We should not, certainly not with the Republican Party, but there's no one... But that is the problem. In fact, I was just at dinner, and a guy was, for some reason, arguing with me, saying that voting for the Democratic Party, rather than, say,
Green Party...
The Green Party has the effect of maintaining this institution that has all of the qualities that that you described, Kevin.
And
you
while know, that's true,
the only thing is that some that the Republicans are going to put up some creature from the Black Lagoon again. And people are going to say, well, if we don't vote for Hillary, then, this, whoever they got going, Ted Cruz is going to get it.
Hey, throw that Ted Cruz in. Just go for it.
And Ted Cruz is going to say, yeah, we want to get rid of abortion, that there shouldn't be rights for gays. Let's take off all of the restrictions against gun ownership so people can have their own tanks.
And he'll show that he'll show his crazy and he won't get elected.
Yeah. Can I just say, I will not vote for anyone who advocates killing millions of third world civilians in each decade.
Well, you know what? I think that is an ethical choice.
Yeah.
And sometimes, I don't know, for years I never voted for any Democrat. In fact, the first Democrat I ever voted for was in 2004 because I thought, Bush had stolen the 2000 election, had lied about this war that had created exactly the situation that you described, Kevin, and I thought it was a referendum. And I think he lost the referendum, Bush did. I think he stole that election as well. The idea then of having, John McCain, maybe I would have gone, if it would have been him and somebody unlike Sarah Palin, maybe I would have continued to vote for a third party, but,
that was too scary.
Yeah. Kevin, I gotta move on. Give me a final statement.
Final statement. How about stop, just to the people, whoever's listening, stop making a choice of the lesser of two evils and voting for a Republican or a Democrat.
Okay.
No difference, really.
All right.
It's all going to lead us to the same place.
Let me ask you one. I just said, here, the thing, food stamps.
There are some differences.
The Republicans, here we got an economy that's not working very well. You can talk forever whose fault it is. But the Republicans want to take $40 billion away from the program. The Democrats want to take
$5
billion. Food stamps.
Yeah.
Yeah, food stamps.
And they have taken some away already. They're
already, yeah, which hurts people. So, anyway, I asked you
the greatest country. I was having this conversation today with someone earlier. We're the greatest country in the world, and this is the first time since the 60s when the Food Stamp Act was enacted that there's been any major cutback like that or any cutback, right?
Particularly at a time,
when people need it the most. Yeah. It's absolutely inexcusable.
All right. Thank you very much, Kevin. You make some good points and a lot of them I agree with. All right. Bye-bye. Yeah, here, this article, just in 1 week, $5 billion in SNAP, food stamp cuts, is already having an impact. And again, if you're anything like a middle class person, a working class, you can say, some of it, the cutbacks, I forgot where, it was fairly 10 or 20 bucks a month. Say 10 or 20 bucks? What the hell? What's that?
It makes a huge difference to people who already can't. I say this every time we talk about this. They already can't make it to the end of the month. They can't make it the 4 weeks they need to make it already.
And the idea,
they're pushed to the limit already.
This Calvinist view, this mean-spirited, punitive spirit that inhabits these right wingers.
Yeah.
Well, they would look for a job. They wouldn't, and they said, well, they do have a job. Most of the people on food stamps have a job. Well, then they ought to get a better job. Well, somebody's got to fill those positions. Yeah? And then you say, well, how about if you give them a raise? Like there's now. I guess President Obama is floating the idea of a $10 an hour, $10, 10 cent an hour minimum wage raise. Oh, no, we can't have that.
Let's not be fair.
But here, when you call it whether you call it a cut or a reduction or a stimulus sunset, the drop in food stamp funding that began in that began on November 1st is unique in the history of the program, as you said, Jillian. Unlike the almost $40 billion House Republicans would like to slash from the program, which would largely come from limiting enrollment, or the Senate's $4 billion reduction, which would trim the administration's budget, the $5 billion cut is directly coming out of recipients' checks. And you know who the largest number of people, people on food stamps is? Children.
Yes.
So you want to...
You want to starve children. You want to make children suffer more than they already are. These people, I could say what I wanted to say.
Well, you said, well, we can't afford it. You know, we have problem. You know, we have a debt problem. We have a deficit problem.
Move some money around, jerk offs.
How about from the Pentagon?
Thank you.
Yeah. The article, what article is it? The New York Times says that it opens with the premise that cutting $10 or $20 out of a monthly food budget wouldn't be all that difficult for many. But the pair speak to residents of Charleston, South Carolina, and New York City, for whom margins were already very thin before the benefits were reduced.
Yeah.
And they make a convincing case that the cuts hurt. There's the man who spends half of his, and this is what you're talking about, half of his $800 Social Security check on rent. His November food stamp budget of $33 is always gone.
$33.
You know how many millionaires there are in Congress? Can we get a researcher, a night call researcher? What's the average wealth of somebody in the Senate? And most of these people in the House of Representatives are upper middle class to wealthy as well. Let's see. He says there are weeks of grits and margarine for breakfast. Then there's a single mother in the Bronx who's trying to buy less with her benefit and has already turned to a local food bank for help. I try to get most of the things my daughter eats because I can hold the hunger. I'm an adult, but she cannot. They don't understand that there's no food in the fridge. You know, folks,
that makes me just so
at my house,
cry.
I came home. I went to Royal Oak Farmers Market, and I said, boy, summer's almost gone. So I bought all these veggies, and I bought a huge jar of honey. I just bought all this stuff, and I brought it home. And my wife said, why did you buy all that? The refrigerator is stuffed. We can't even get everything in there. That's me. That's me.
Yeah.
And then
I know.
This person says there's no food in the fridge.
$33 a month. And I spent like $10 on dessert tonight, you know? I mean, it just... Ugh.
Did you see who's one of the biggest recipients of food stamps, by the way? Not people. What store? Walmart.
Oh, yeah. The employees.
No, the shoppers spend about 18% of all food stamps.
Oh, the
at
shoppers.
Walmart. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that story. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, this adds up to $14 billion of the $80 billion Congress sets aside for food stamps.
Wow.
You know, there's something really perverse here. I mean, one of the groups of people that buy at Walmart are the Walmart employees because they make so little from these.
That they get government assistance.
Yeah.
Themselves.
And so not only are we paying the health care. Up till now,
for Walmart employees,
for Walmart because they qualify for Medicaid, we're also paying for their food stamps, which they then turn around and give back to Walmart.
Boy,
there's something evil here, folks.
It's called Walmart.
It's called Walmart. Thank you. Yeah, let me see if there's anything more on this. I can't even read. The total profits for 2013 of Walmart was $17 billion. In other words, the food stamps spent at Walmart was the margin of profit for the company.
Whoa.
I mean,
whoa.
This is.
My gosh.
Yeah, well, I don't even know what to say.
I know.
Yeah. What is the thing? I don't know whether it
makes me hate him more.
Poop or go blind.
I haven't heard that one, but okay.
Yeah.
It works.
The estimates come as 47 million Americans are slated to lose their food stamp benefits as funding for the program expires. Indeed, the former recipients are likely to become even more dependent on the low-cost retailer. Bill Simon, Walmart's U.S. CEO, says, I would say we're cautious, but modestly optimistic. When the food stamp benefits expanded, our market share actually went down. What are you talking about? The chain has traditionally lobbied around food stamps. What does that mean?
The chain is lobbied around food stamps. Yes, I don't know.
According to, and worked with, you know, they do this, when you go to the Royal Oak Farmers Market, they have this big truck. I don't know whether delivering food or what. What would they be doing? Maybe they were buying it for food pantries because they're getting the idea that Walmart is thought of as not being a real good company.
Yeah.
That they're
kind of mean
and greedy.
Yeah.
That the family is four or five of them are the richest 10 Americans. And their employees can't even afford health care, which they don't
give.
Yeah.
They think can be as rich as they want. You can be as rich as you want, but don't conduct your business that way.
Yeah. Now.
Inexcusable.
You know what do they say, though, about the rich? They're creating the jobs. Well, first off.
They're creating the jobs so these people can.
That's the kind of jobs they're creating. The other jobs they're exporting out of the United States. But here, and there's something called where was that? You know, this is the fact that I don't even have the tip of my tongue. Trans-Pacific Pact? Is that a wait a minute? Trans-Pacific Treaty. Trans-Pacific Treaty. I'm totally losing it. But what this is another one of these NAFTA.
Oh,
deals.
Yeah, like
and this is going to include everybody trade. From Vietnam, wherever the Pacific hits. So that's Vietnam and us. And this is January 1st is going to be the 20th anniversary of NAFTA.
Is it really?
Yeah. The United States still losing 500,000 industrial jobs a year. But here, this is on the New York Times Sunday Business section. Treasure Hunters of 2008. 2008, that's when... Reaganomics came home to roost, and everything collapsed, and it wasn't for the government bailout, there'd probably be a worldwide depression. It said 5 years ago, the global financial system was falling apart. Lehman Brothers had imploded. Banks had stopped lending. Foreclosure signs were as common as weeds on the front lawns of suburban homes. And Bruce A. Karsh saw the buying opportunity of a lifetime. Mr. Karsh, a low-key money manager from Los Angeles, had spent his career analyzing and trading the debt of companies. Now, if you don't know exactly what that means, this is
where they buy up the companies.
And yeah, and when you can't understand an economic system, you know it's being run by elites for their benefit. So the article in the Times goes on. With the world economy buckling, the prices of corporate debt had plunged to levels suggesting that much of the American industry was hurtling towards bankruptcy. So Mr. Karsh, through his Oak Tree Capital Management firm, plowed money into distressed debt at a torrid pace, investing more than $6 billion over a three-month period.
Yeesh.
Howard S. Marks, Oak Tree's chairman, wrote to their clients in 2008, unless the second Great Depression lies ahead, today's purchases should produce substantial returns, and in a few years we'll reminisce together about how easy it was to take advantage of the bargains of 2008 and 2009. It didn't exactly hit the rest of us like that, did it? So the Times says it paid off. With the help of an extraordinary government bailout and stimulus, the second Great Depression never came, and a global recession eventually faded, at least for the big shots. A half a decade later, Mr. Mark's prediction has come to pass. Virtually all of the debt bought on the cheap has fully recovered in value. The trade yielded spectacular profits, earning about $6 billion in gains for Oak Tree's investors and $1.5 billion for Mr. Karsh, Mr. Marks, and their partners. So, going back to figures, that figure of $6 billion is exactly what was cut off of the food stamps.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Yes.
And $1.5 billion, and the jobs they created was...
none.
None. So they didn't produce jobs. They produced wealth that isn't even real wealth because no one spends it. No one invests it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right. Well, let's do this. I want to get, Dez is calling from Ferndale about food stamps, and Ron from Shelby Township. Ron, I'm going to want to talk to you because I don't know whether you heard, but somebody from Sweden was dissing you out.
You have people dissing you from clear across the world.
From a socialist country.
Oh.
We'll be right back.
Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jaleen will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night call.
I try to find the right one, but it seems like they all just have one thing on their mind.
Having only one thing on your mind can be a good thing when you find that special someone. At Geico.com, that someone is a car insurance policy, and the only thing on its mind is being your soulmate. Depend on easy online tools for paying bills and managing claims. Picture a life of savings as you gaze into the eyes of a free rate quote. That's our go-to move. Geico, 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
What you're supposed to do to take care of your tires by Mike Rowe.
You know, I don't really know what you're supposed to do. You know who does, though? The tire experts in the service department at your Ford dealership.
Get up to $140 in mail-in rebates on four select tires when you use the Ford Service Credit Card. Click on the banner now. Subject to credit approval, rebates by check. Other tire manufacturer rebate or offer cannot be combined or Ford Service Credit Card rebate or offer. See your participating Ford dealer for rebate details through 12/31/13.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. Honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes or if the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
Hi, thank you very much. This is our final segment, so get in on it. 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743.
You go to Facebook.com/Night Call. Great new photograph of me and Jolene.
We had a little pre-show dinner tonight.
Yeah, we did. And it's not a Chinese restaurant. It's my house. There's just some Chinese writing on the wall. Facebook.com/Night Call. You can text us at 4WRIF. That's 49743. My website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. I'm going to be talking with Peter Kornblum. You know, it's coming up on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John Kennedy. And
yeah, there's a lot of buzz around it this week.
60% of the American people, and it's got to be the vast majority of American people now alive, were either not alive when that occurred 50 years ago, mm-hmm. or were, you know, kind of young.
Yes.
So still, 60% of us think there was a conspiracy. Peter Kornblum, who is an incredible guy, he's head of the Chile and Cuban Documentation Center. And I've interviewed him before. He's got great stuff.
Incredible.
He's got the goods on Henry Kissinger and Nixon for creating this fascist coup in Chile in 1973. But he writes all the time for Cigar Aficionado magazine.
Yeah.
So he writes about Cuba for him, and it's called The Darkest Day. And he thinks that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin.
You know, I mean, I'm looking forward to hearing your interview, Peter, as I always am. In fact, I heard one of your interviews this morning when I was coming into work at 6 a.m. But I just am one of these people that I just, I don't know.
Don't care?
I mean, I don't care.
I don't know who killed Kennedy. I think it was Oswald. He had some help. But
I mean, I care that he died, and you know, I thought he had a lot of great ideals as a president, and cared more about the people than a lot of other presidents did. But you know, I have no interest in sitting around and arguing who did it.
Well, I'm also going to interview this coming week for next Sunday, Lamar Waldron, who's written another book about the Kennedy assassination, where he says it was a mob hit, that the mafia did it. And in fact,
now I would think that might be more along the lines, if I cared at all.
Leonardo,
let's make it sexy.
Leonardo DiCaprio is going to be in a film based on one of Lamar Waldron's books.
Cool.
So that is coming up. Also, Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, he's going to talk about the late Howard Zinn. And
now this I'm really interested in.
And also there was this Zinn Reedin, because the ex-governor, now the president of Purdue University, tried to ban Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. All this on my website, peterwerbe.com. All right, let's get some people on the air.
Yes, we've got a few phone calls. This is your last chance to call. We've got about 20 minutes left of the show.
All right, here is Dez. Dez is in Ferndale. Go ahead, Dez, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter and Julian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We chatted once before here back in May after I tried to kill myself, so I'm using a different name now.
Okay.
Please. I'm calling about the food stamp issue. I just had my benefits reduced by $11 here. After I came out of prison 5 years ago, I've been on food stamps ever since at $200 a month. And I am out of money as of today, and I still have 8 days to go yet before I get more money on a food stamp card.
See, this is exactly what I'm talking about. I know of what I speak. You're stretched already, and here it is. I mean,
let me ask you a question, Des. I suspect there are probably people saying, wait a minute, this guy was an ex-con. He's talking about, you know, almost having killed himself, and I don't want to have to pay for food stamps for this guy. What would you say to that? Something you can say on the air.
I agree with them. They're entitled to have that opinion, and if that's the way they feel, then I believe that they're correct. I certainly don't feel that way myself. I've had a legitimate need. I haven't traded any of my food stamp money for drugs or beer or alcohol or cigarettes. I've used it for its intended purpose, and I shop responsibly, too. So, you know, I'd like to think that I am giving something back responsibly to the people that are paying for my food.
You know, one of the things that happens when they cut food stamps, retailers don't have the sales that they did. I mean, they're essentially, if they're going to cut even cut $5 billion out of food stamps. That means $5 billion less. That's going into the
business owners.
That's going into, yeah, because the whole economy, you know, works on government stimulus. I mean, the major one, of course, being the military-industrial complex, but it's also stuff like this. I mean, we give nobody complain, except for a few crazy Republicans. Has any problem with giving money to our seniors in the form of any number of programs? Most don't about Medicaid. But if you started taking all that away, who knows what would happen? Certainly if you took away the military-industrial complex without and what they suck up from our taxes.
Let's take a little dent out of it.
Yeah.
Let's start with that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, there's food banks. I hope that you can explore that. And I know there are some churches in Ferndale.
Thank you, Des.
Will help people out.
Well, the other thing is he had an interesting phrase there. He said, shop responsibly. It is hard for people that don't have real good knowledge of nutrition. You probably could eat a non-American-like diet and survive even a $50 of food a month.
True.
That is, if you ate just, you know, went to like food co-ops and got whole grains and, but if you wanted to have anything like
rice and beans and things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah. I mean, most Americans would feel terribly deprived.
Yes.
But you could have a nutritious, and if you knew the cooking skills, that's another thing. And if you didn't have your utilities turned off, like happens to a lot of people in Detroit, you could cook nutritious meals. Nutritious? Yeah, that's a word.
I think there just needs to be more education about all that.
Well, yeah, and that's not done. So, you know, hey, you're poor. Here's your food stamps. I mean, why wouldn't there be community-based programs to show people how to cook, to make, you know, like...
You know, I'm a chef. I should think about this.
You know, what we had, Jalene was a guest at our house. My wife and I had Jalene over for dinner.
I invited
dinner.
Myself over.
She actually did. But if you think what we had, that was a relatively inexpensive meal.
It really was.
And it was very tasty.
You know, it was all vegetarian. For starters.
You know what? It was vegan. I never even thought about that, wasn't it?
No, I think it was vegan.
Yeah. I didn't intend that.
Yeah, but it was absolutely delicious. Yeah. You know, it was parsley and tomato and Brussels.
People are going to go, oh, my God.
No, and the soup,
potato leek soup. Oh, man, that was good.
It's delicious.
And then there was tabbouleh, which is a parsley
and cracked wheat salad. Pine nuts
in there.
Oh, and a little rice peel off. That's where the pine nuts were. Those are expensive. You have to leave those out.
Yeah, get those out.
Those are really expensive. Oops.
You're having a lot of bad time with
This microphone has got issues,
So you could do it, but that takes sort of a retraining of people's...
skill set.
Yeah, skill set. Thank you.
Shopping.
Let's get back into some more of this. Here is Josh in Lincoln Park. Josh, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you guys doing?
We're good. What's up?
I was just wondering, you guys were going to be talking about the John F. Kennedy assassination.
Right.
Well, I mean, I've done some research, you know, and the whole conspiracy thing is some conspiracies could be fake, could be real. It's just, it's more word of mouth of anything. But the research that I've done, I think that most of the things that are conspiracies are just cover-ups for what really happened.
Give me an example. What do you mean? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure of the drug that I remember researching it, but I'm not sure what is in it. But when you said Colombia, that's what caught my attention on the radio.
Okay.
When you said the Colombian Association, or whoever you said, I researched that in Colombia there's this plant that they make, and it could be a form into a powder or into a liquid. Well, people have been given this.
Cocaine? The coca plants?
No. It's not cocaine.
No.
But it's powdery. Like, it could be cocaine.
Well, what does this have to do with the Kennedy assassination?
Because he said the cartel, the mob.
I think is that somebody, let's just say the government or whoever, they gave him this drug, and it makes you do whatever they want you to do. There's been examples. I forgot the name of the website, but they were talking to some person.
What's that truth drug, Peter?
Yeah,
back
in
the day.
So you think they gave that to Oswald?
That's what I think they did.
Okay, well,
I think that to him, because you know, on TV, they would say, "How can anybody shoot somebody that quick?
Right.
You know, with that kind of rifle."
Right.
Well, if you tell somebody to do something quick as possible, and on that drug, they're going to do it without hesitating. Because they don't know. Something in their brain is powered off.
Yeah, I think this shot with this rifle called a Mannlicher Carcano World War I surplus. What did he bought it for, like $18? You know, he was fairly close, a lot closer than people realize. The Book Depository building in Dealey Plaza was closer than one would think, but
I've done that whole tour, believe it.
Really?
For my lack of interest in
Well,
it.
Well, how far?
I've done the whole tour from the grassy knoll, not far at all.
Yeah, but he had it was a bolt-action rifle. And so here he's about to commit, regicide, if you will, you know, the kill the king and everything that represents, right? Essentially killing the father, all the Freudian implications of that. So you got to have a pretty steady hand. So you shoot and, you know, you think that's easy, but, you know, the human head is not that big a target, even from, you know, 100 yards or wherever far he was. So he gets one shot off and then he has to, grab the bolt, eject the shell that's in there, slam it shut, re-aim, and then get another shot off. Doesn't sound good to me.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. All right. Well, Ron, if you can stay up a little bit, just in about 15 minutes, we're going to have a guy that thinks it wasn't
Josh.
A conspiracy.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did I say?
Ron.
Josh. Okay. Thank you, Josh.
So, wait, 1 o'clock, it's a guy who thinks that what?
Well, that's not what it's about. Actually, there is a Cuba connection. Kennedy, a representative, I'm giving it away a little, but, well, I won't.
Give a small tease.
A small tease was that the assassination of Kennedy actually sunk the possibility of the relationship with Cuba that Kennedy wanted to have.
Oh, that's all going to open back up again. I know it. I just know it. You've been there 3 times. I'm going next time. That's it.
Okay. You want to go in March?
Saving my pennies. Oh, I don't. I need a little longer to save money for that trip.
All right. Let's go to Ron. Ron is in Shelby Township. Ron, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Peter, Jolene. I just wanted to comment on the two guys that called in talking about Obama, and they are absolutely right. They hit the nail right on the head. This country, I just want to say, this country is probably the most criminal. We have the most criminal government in the world right now, and everything that
you think it's worse.
Oh my gosh!
You think it's worse than Syria?
I just want to say.
Wait a minute!
No,
do you think it's worse than Syria?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
Right. No, President Assad of Syria. He loved his people. Okay?
Oh my God!
Except the ones that didn't like him, and then he would poison gas him.
Off with your head!
What criminal activity is Obama involved in?
Well, what happened in Syria? those were the rebels that did, and we supplied those rebels, okay?
What?
It wasn't him. It wasn't his government.
But you support Syria, the Syrian government?
Yeah, well, President Assad, he was good.
Okay, let's leave that aside. What are the criminal acts that
President Obama
is involved in?
Well, what I want to say is all of this that's happening, okay, in the world, in this country, it's all by design, okay? It's all been in the planning since the Kennedy years.
All right, wait. Let's go back a few. Last time you were on, you said that the website was going to cost each American citizen, the healthcare website was going to cost everybody $2 million apiece.
It has cost $600 million.
It hasn't costed in the past tense, and now they're saying it's probably going to cost about $125 million. But you said that it amounts to $2 million per citizen last week. Do you want to stick with that figure?
Well, it is over $600 million.
Do you want to stick with the $2 million per person?
I probably meant to say $2 per person.
Okay. You're right. Yeah. That's what it was. It's $2.
The figure is $663 million.
Well, that's the figure that had been repeated, but for one thing, that's not what it cost to set up a website. It cost probably now not that much, but probably a sixth of that, which is about $125 million, and that means that's going to be over this extended period where they're going to be enrolling people. It's not just for setting up a website and having links and
It's maintaining. It's payroll. It's all kinds of things.
Yeah, so there's a lot of
people. It's a huge undertaking. It's the first time we've had a national health care system ever.
Yeah, I wonder, probably everybody wonders when the government is getting a contract, whether it's putting in a sidewalk or running a healthcare website, could we have gotten it done cheaper? Probably so. But so what's the big grand conspiracy?
Well, everything that's happening is by design. Like I said, it's been in the planning since the Kennedy years, okay, and it all these false flags that we've been having, you know, like Sandy Hook and whatever the Boston bombing and everything is all by design.
Well, do you think that the people behind it all are of any particular religion?
The people that are behind it are the Illuminati. You're globalists. You're globalist elite.
The Illuminati. Wow.
Yeah, it all has to do with Agenda 21 and the New World Order.
Well, we went through Agenda 21. You know, there's a book.
It used to be like a wrestling organization.
I
got to
tell you, Ron, there's a book called The Illuminati by Robert Anton Wilson. Called The Illuminati. It's a three-part book. It's fiction. It's kind of science fiction-y. But it is a great read, an absolutely great read. But I don't know. I got to head on, but I don't know. All right. I appreciate your call. Thank you very much.
We did get somewhere, though, with Ron.
Yeah. But it wasn't $2 million.
It was the $2.
I think he, in fairness, I think he did misspeak himself.
Yes.
Because he couldn't have said $2 million. Well, I don't know. We see. I don't even think Ron heard that earlier in the show. We read this letter from Scott, who writes in from Sweden, who says he's a proud member of the greatest nanny state of them all, which is Sweden. He was challenging that figure of $2 million per person.
He was correct to do so.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've got about 5 minutes left. Your deal. You want to?
What haven't we covered? That's the question.
I always look around. I'm thinking this is all bad news. How about this? A massive toxic Japanese tsunami island of trash is headed towards the U.S. It sounds like a joke almost.
It does sound like a joke, but that is no joke, and it came from this. You know, I mean. We're in touch with a lot of organizations who are anti-nuke and who have been talking about this. And I have friends who are – that's their entire focus is what went on in Fukushima. And this is an enormous – this was from the Independent UK, which is –
The Independent.
Credible.
Which is an
newspaper.
It's a newspaper, right.
An enormous floating island of debris from Japan's 2011 tsunami is drifting toward the coast of America, bringing with it over 1 million tons of junk that would cover an area the size of Texas, our favorite state, Peter.
Yeah, Texas.
The most, the most concentrated stretch, dubbed the Toxic Monster, is currently around 1,700 miles off the coast, sitting between Hawaii and California. But several million tons of additional debris remains scattered across the Pacific. Now, we've seen these stories about the big trash mounds that are floating in the ocean. But this is toxic debris. I mean, not that the other stuff isn't toxic.
Well, one of the things that is a surprise to people, that some of the world's top climate scientists say that wind and solar energy isn't enough to head off extreme global warming that we're beginning to see already, and that environmentalists should support the development of what they call safer nuclear power. This includes the highly respected James Hansen, who is this former top NASA scientist. Now, our friend, who's done anti-nuclear stuff for 40 years, Harvey Wasserman, he's got an article. It's almost all in the headline. Pro-nuke scientists should go to Fukushima in Japan, where these accidents were. And the problem with all this is there's no room for error.
None, zero. Yeah. And this was an error. And
which is continuing.
Yes, which is continuing. The fallout continues. It's not over by any means. And I liked one of the comments that came after this particular news story and said, the safe distance from a nuclear reactor for living creatures is 93 million miles.
That's the sun.
Yeah. There you go.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's do this. I was going to say let's hang it up, but I just want to make sure if there is anybody is there any outstanding emails here? Oh, yeah, this is nice. You know, sometimes we get up on Christianity and Judaism and Islam and
organized
Hinduism.
Religion,
yeah,
that's
a fast way, yeah. But I like this. This is from, J.H., he's a Christian that wants peace and wants it green.
Right on.
Oh, I like that.
See, now, and we always.
This is a good show.
Thank you very much. We always talk about how we know many, many good religious folk who
sure.
are on the right side of things, meaning, you know, for the people,
correct,
about
sir.
The people, the correct side. Yeah. I knew you were going to get me on that one.
He quotes, though, he's an approximate quote of Bob Dylan from this song, Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. There is no left or right, just a top and a bottom.
Oh, boy. That's
yeah.
true. That's
yeah.
true.
Right.
Excellent.
And, okay, let me see. We may have one.
someone calling us communists.
No.
Is that Frank Zappa?
That's Frank Zappa. This is from Ron Paul Rick. what is it? This is a weird.
Communism doesn't work because people like to own stuff.
Yeah, well, that's not why it didn't work. Before I had such a man crush on Ron Paul, I really respected this guy's opinion. You interviewed him, which is true. Was he a self-described conservative? Now, if you
interviewed who?
Frank Zappa. If you you can go look that up. Peter Werby, Frank Zappa, and that'll come up.
You did?
Yeah, a long time ago.
You know, I did not know that.
Look it up.
Wow, your cool factor just went way up.
All right, just a repeat, and we'll get into our interviews. You can check out our Facebook, nice picture of Jalene and me from tonight, at facebook.com/nightcall, and my website, Peter Werby, werbe.com, and we'll do it next week. I am going to return. I'm not even going to tell you where, but when I start the show next week at 11 o'clock, I'm going to have a surprising announcement.
And you better be here.
And no, I'm not having a sex change.
I am.
Will you marry me?
Of course.
Okay. Stay tuned for the interviews.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. We'll return with more Night Call right after this. Night Call. Night Call. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Wait, what?
Everything that rocks.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I think everybody knows we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And it's interesting how this historic event doesn't leave us. Last year, on the occasion, on a phone-in talk show I do for another greater media station in Detroit here, I just opened the lines and I said, let's call me and tell me who you think killed John F. Kennedy. Was it the mafia, the Cubans, the Russians, the right-wing oil financiers, the CIA, or you don't know? It was interesting. The vast majority of people said the CIA. Some said the right wing. I think that could have been it. A couple of people said they didn't know. And at one point, they said to me, well, you didn't say who you thought killed Kennedy, Peter. What do you think? And I said, you know, I don't know. Read a lot of books, a lot of theories about what happened. Almost all involve conspiracies. There's been a bit of I don't know what you'd call it, not a backlash so much, but some work, some scholarly works even, that says, no, in fact, Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. Still, 60% in the last poll I saw, 60% of the American people, even after all of this time, half a century, believed that there was conspiracy involved. The man we're going to speak to is no stranger to the Peter Werby Show. He's Peter Kornbluh. He was just on in September, September 11th, talking about the other September 11th. That's the one that occurred in Chile, where the American government, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, conspired, a real conspiracy, to overthrow the democratically elected government of Chile and ushering in almost two decades of fascism. Peter Kornbluh's book was a Pinochet file, a classified dossier on atrocity and accountability. And that brought some things to light that I'm sure that the majority of American people did not know. Peter Kornbluh is director of the National Security Archive Chile Documentation Project and also the Cuba Documentation Project. He has an interesting article and a challenging article to those of us who believe there was a conspiracy in the November issue of Cigar Aficionado. That's the one where they got anybody from Rush Limbaugh to Fidel Castro with a big old cigar in his mouth. And he thinks that, there wasn't a conspiracy. I think that's right. Peter Kornbluh, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
It's always a pleasure to be talking to you and your audience, Peter.
Are you a cigar smoker, or you just happen to find a spot for the article?
I'm not a cigar smoker, and I should just alert your audience that Fidel Castro stopped smoking cigars decades ago, and he's not either. But Cigar Aficionado certainly has a great interest in Cuba because of cigars, the excellence of Cuban cigars, and the hope that someday they'll be able to be freely sold in the United States of America when and if the embargo is ever lifted.
Yeah.
So they were interested in an article not just about the Kennedy assassination, but about Cuba's kind of position in the various conspiracy theories about who killed Kennedy and why.
Yeah. You know, you can actually go just about 9 miles south of where I'm broadcasting and get those Cohibas in Windsor, but that's not exactly legal. Yeah, I actually read the article. For one thing, I saw Rush Limbaugh in 1 month in Cigar Aficionado. I said, it must be a bunch of right-wingers. Then the next month, they had Fidel, and he did say that he no longer smoked them, that they were only for export and also for his health. Peter Kornbluh is my guest, and I don't know. I guess people like us are usually used to having minority views, but this one's interesting. You don't think that there was a conspiracy that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. Am I correct?
Well, I'm certainly in the minority. Recent opinion polls show at least 75% of the American public think that Oswald did not act alone, either had other people involved with him or wasn't even the shooter. And those, you know, those conspiracy theories have evolved from a number of issues that I write about in this article in Cigar Aficionado. One is the extraordinary secrecy that there was around the Kennedy assassination for many, many years, all the way into the 1990s, where CIA files and FBI files and even the investigative files of the Warren Commission were still sealed. And that allowed a movie called JFK, starring Kevin Costner and directed by Oliver Stone, to postulate a conspiracy theory that was put forth by the prosecutor in New Orleans, Jim Garrison, that a whole host of kind of national security types killed Kennedy. The movie was really utter fiction. Garrison had the most disreputable of approaches to his investigation. He initially claimed that the Kennedy assassination was a homosexual thrill killing. He tried to prosecute a businessman who he claimed was gay and failed on trumped-up charges. That was the only prosecution of anybody related to the Kennedy assassination. So secrecy has fostered a kind of a void in which these theories have evolved. The movie JFK, advancing a conspiracy theory, was very popular. More people have got a chance to see the movie than to read all the declassified documents.
Sure.
There's a lot of people out there who have made it kind of a lifetime commitment to write about various aspects of the Kennedy assassination, setting aside the argument and the official conclusion of the Warren Commission that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone.
You know, there's other, of course, more reputable theories about this. In fact, I'm going to interview, and you may be familiar with him, Lamar Waldron. He wrote a huge book along with talk show host Tom Hartman, who's, you know, you say talk show host, sort of a disreputable character.
Yes, and their book is being turned into a huge popular Hollywood movie.
Is it?
To come, starring Leonard DiCaprio and Robert De Niro. So
well, forget it.
Even more people.
I know.
It's there's a conspiracy.
It's called The Hidden History.
Out there.
The one I'm going to be interviewing Lamar Waldron next week is called The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. And he puts it at the feet of the New Orleans mafia godfather, Carlos Marcello. And it's, you know, he's a researcher like you are, Peter Kornblum. He has all these
I know Lamar, and I've met with him, and I've read his book. The one you're talking about is, I think, his third or fourth book on the Kennedy assassination. And it's not the one that is actually being made into the movie. But and I have great respect for his talents as a researcher. The problem is that it's easy to write books drawing on kind of cherry-picking declassified documents and evidence to make an argument about motivation to kill Kennedy. But it's a lot harder to then arrive at the bridge between those who are supposedly motivated, like the mafia or the CIA, and their actual connection to Oswald. And the ballistic evidence, the fingerprint evidence, the eyewitness testimony, these are things that really can't be overcome when it comes right down to it.
Well,
Oswald was the shooter. And the question then remains is, did somebody put him up to it? Was some nefarious force behind him? And that is what a lot of these conspiracy theorists are focusing on.
You know, Mark Lane, one of the first people that began investigating the claims of the Warren Commission, and I should say, I don't want to get too far away either from your article that appeared in the November issue of Cigar Aficionado, The Darkest Day. My guest is Peter Kornblum, and we're going to be talking about how Cuba figures into all of this. But Mark Lane was my parents' assemblyman, state assemblyman in New York City when they had moved there from Detroit. And so he began, he wrote this book called Rush to Judgment, and then he did this film. In the film, Lee Harvey Oswald is brought into the Dallas police station. He's beaten up pretty badly. He had just did kill a police officer and a Dallas police officer, and he looks totally disheveled, totally confused. A microphone is shoved in front of his face, and a newsman says, "Why did you kill the president?" Suddenly, he just becomes completely alert. His eyes pop wide open, and he says, "Oh, so I'm the patsy." Now, that's not good evidence, right?
Well, that's a statement by a guy who we all know had serious mental and anger issues in his life. And it's neither here nor there. I mean, he may have wanted to cast himself that way in the very first minutes, but the ballistic evidence and the rest of the evidence placing him as the shooter is pretty much incontrovertible. So the rifle that he sent paid $21 for through mail order is the gun that fired the bullets that killed John Kennedy. And there are theorists out there that claim there was another shooter. Somehow he coordinated the other shooter coordinated their shots with Oswald at the very same moment, you know, from the grassy knoll. But the fact of the matter is that Oswald fired the rifle that killed Kennedy. He had used the rifle to try and assassinate another political figure in Dallas just a few weeks before. That part of it really is not worth debating. I talked to you at length about Mark Lane. He was the original conspiracy theorist, starting with the argument that Oswald was innocent. He was got himself hired to be Oswald's mother's lawyer. She was absolutely crazy. He testified before the Warren Commission, complete malarkey. And I have to say, with all due respect to him, he kind of was the first person to arrive on the great train of money grubbing and notoriety to take advantage of what is truly one of the great national tragedies of the recent history of the United States of America, the assassination of John F. Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963.
And it's what you call the darkest day. That's the name of your article in the November issue of Cigar Aficionado. My guest is Peter Kornbluh. But what about the Umbrella Man? Never mind. I'll get into that with...
We would need 5 or 6 hours on your show to do all of the cockamamie theories that there are out there.
One thing, Peter Kornbluh, you don't do, and that's involve yourself in cockamamie theory. Your research, what you've exposed about Chile, about Cuba, the United States foreign policy, is absolutely invaluable. And we could argue. I don't even have the arguments to refute to what you're saying anyway. So I have to cede the ground to you on that. But Cuba and the JFK assassination. Of course, some people say that it was originated as a payback for the United States' attempt to assassinate Fidel Castro. Open up and tell us about how this all falls together.
Well, there's a lot of different conspiracy theories, and a lot of different kind of general aspects to them. When you talk to Lamar Waldron, you'll be focusing on kind of the mafia aspect. But Cuba falls into these conspiracy theories on two sides. There are a number of theorists that say that Fidel Castro killed Kennedy before Kennedy could kill Fidel Castro. The CIA was certainly involved in multiple assassination attempts against Castro. He certainly knew about them. He made a pretty significant reference to them in September of 1963 to an Associated Press reporter, which was then turned into a major article by the Associated Press that Lee Harvey Oswald likely read. In New Orleans, in the New Orleans Times-Picayune, because he read that paper every day. He, of course, was a great Castro sympathizer and revolutionary wannabe, and this may have motivated him to go after the president. But one of the great historic coincidences is that on the very day, at the very moment of the assassination, the CIA had a top-level operative in Paris passing a paper mate pen that had been converted into a secret assassination device with a hypodermic needle inside that could be filled with poison. And the CIA operative in Paris, at the very moment Kennedy was killed, was handing this pen to one of the CIA's highest assets in the Cuban military, trying to recruit him to assassinate Fidel Castro by pricking Castro with this, kind of rigged pen, poison pen. And the story usually stops there, and people go, "Wow, that's really incredible." Of course, the would-be assassin says to the CIA guy, "I'm not going on a suicide mission, dude. You know, give me a sniper rifle so I can shoot Castro from 100 yards away and somehow escape." But
Peter Kornbluh, how do we know this information? I mean, how do you talk about this?
This is actually in a secret CIA history of its assassination attempts against Fidel Castro.
Okay.
And even underlined in the secret history, which was written in 1967 and then obtained by a Senate investigative committee in the mid-1970s and published for the first time, in this history, the CIA itself, its own inspector general, has underlined a statement which says, as I quote in the article, at the very moment, it appears that at the very moment the president was shot in Dallas, a CIA operative was handing an assassination device to a Cuban military officer in Paris.
Huh.
Now, here's the other coincidence, though, on November 22nd. At the very moment that that was happening in Paris, at the very moment that the president was shot in Dallas, the president had his own emissary meeting with Fidel Castro in Varadero Beach and passing Castro a message of potential reconciliation, saying that Kennedy basically thought he'd learned the lessons of history with Cuba, that there's some things the United States wanted Cuba to change in terms of its relations with the Soviet Union, its intervention in revolutionary movements in Latin America, but that Kennedy believed that, you know, the Cold War could be warmed a bit, there could be detente in the Caribbean, and a socialist Cuba could coexist with a capitalist United States of America. And they literally were discussing this message from Kennedy when an aide came to Castro and said, the president has been shot in Dallas. And they turned on a radio and listened, and when it was announced that Kennedy had died, Castro said, this is terrible. There goes your mission of peace. And then he said, and they're going to say we did it,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, is true. Quite a few people immediately came out, including right-wing Cuban exiles, the CIA itself, and others, to say that the Cubans were behind the assassination, and a number of very high U.S. officials initially believed that, among them our ambassador to Mexico, and even apparently Lyndon Johnson for a while. Now, there's another side to this, which
okay.
is that, and my article is really about this other side, which is that Kennedy, of course, was involved for 6 months before his murder of trying to improve relations secretly with Cuba. And right at the time he was murdered, he was in the middle of setting up a meeting between Fidel Castro and one of Kennedy's top aides, a man named William Atwood. And there's speculation by a number of theorists, including a new book that's come out recently called JFK, The Unspeakable, by James Douglas, is that, you know, the CIA opposed this, the
right.
exiles opposed this, and they somehow took upon themselves to kill Kennedy before he could end the Cold War in the Caribbean.
This was an aha moment, right?
This was an aha moment. Well, nobody knew about this. You know, the CIA knew about the secret initiative with Castro.
I meant now.
Right,
I mean,
reason.
When people began learning about it, they said, aha, here is the basis of the root of the conspiracy led by the CIA. Not only were they concerned about Cuba, but they were also concerned, allegedly, that JFK opposed an escalation in Vietnam, so the CIA move to eliminate him. If I don't know if you remember the X-Files, but in that, I mean, I thought this was amazing. They actually show a J. Edgar Hoover figure, a military guy, and some just shadowy guys with suits on plotting the murder of John F. Kennedy. So in the popular imagination, I mean, I don't think anybody could, I couldn't stand up to your refutations of the conspiracy theory, but when you have popular culture that is inundated with the message, vast conspiracy of, you know, rooted in different evil sectors, no wonder everybody believes that Lee Harvey Oswald was either not the shooter or not the only one.
Well, there's a couple of things here, Peter, they're very important. As I say, you can create a long list of you know, U.S. military generals, of CIA officials, of FBI officials, including J. Edgar Hoover, who hated the Kennedys for a wide variety of reasons. But that doesn't necessarily implicate them in what would be an extraordinary crime, orchestrating through a conspiracy, which would have to involve, you know, dozens of people, a coordinated assassination of the President of the United States. And making the leap from motivation to actual implementation and culpability is the kind of the big void that for me, conspiracy theorists really can't overcome, particularly when the evidence is crystal clear that Oswald himself was the shooter. So then the issue is, did he have anybody behind him? Was he manipulated? Was he a patsy, et cetera? So I actually come down on this great irony. Oswald was motivated by having read this article about U.S. aggression towards Cuba. He wanted to go to Cuba. He wanted to find a community of revolutionaries. You know, he defected before to the Soviet Union. He was a revolutionary wannabe. And, you know, this opportunity fell into his lap that the president's motorcade was going to pass right below the window of the building where he had gotten a job just a few weeks before. And he got that job not through any conspiracy to get that job, but through a friend of his wife's, who his wife was begging her friends, find my husband a job. He's unemployed. He's beating the hell out of me every night with his frustration and his anger. We don't have any food for our little babies. Find my husband a job. And they found him one. One of her friends found him a job at the book repository, and lo and behold, the president shows up. He has already purchased this rifle long before, and he takes the opportunity to shoot the president. And he thinks he's helping Cuba, but the great irony of this history is that he did not know that he terminated, when he killed the president, a major initiative, the first major initiative to improve relations with Cuba. And the secret history of that initiative is what I write about in my Cigar Aficionado article and in a book I'll be publishing next year on the untold history, the hidden history of U.S. diplomacy with Cuba. It's an extraordinary history. People are going to seize on it to kind of talk about more conspiracy about Kennedy. But I think what I wrote in the article is correct, and I hope people will consider it.
Sure. It's called The Darkest Day, and it's in the November issue of Cigar Aficionado. Just a minute or two left with Peter Kornbluh. I do agree that I don't think very many institutions, whether it's the mob or the CIA or the Castro government or Russia or whoever, even right-wing oil billionaires, would dare to commit an act like this. Certainly the idea, Lamar Waldron's book, that it was the mob, they were angry because that the Kennedys had put all this heat on the mafia. Well, I got an idea. Let's kill the president. That'll take the heat off. It doesn't make a bit of sense. But let me ask you one general question. Why do you think the American public, after half a century, have such an enduring interest in this?
I think that the Kennedy assassination was a huge shock to the country at a great turning point in our country's history. I think that secrecy has fostered a growing interest and a continuing interest, as well as created a void in which all these conspiracy theories have been put forth and seized upon by an American public that doesn't trust its government, and rightfully so. I mean, the FBI and the CIA did cover up information about Oswald and about its own operations. The CIA never told the investigating Warren Commission that they had been trying to kill Castro because they considered that too big of a secret, or that they had been kind of watching Oswald move around. But there are bureaucratic reasons and secrecy reasons that I think are more logical to explain this cover-up than a conspiracy to actually kill the president. And the third issue, which I hope you and your listeners will consider about why this is so important, is, you know, you have a huge crime, just a major shocking crime, and you have this one little guy, Lee Harvey Oswald, skinny kind of runt of a guy, apparently, you know, a bit of a nut, emotionally deranged, angry, and, you know, his stature just doesn't fit the magnitude of the crime, and so people are more willing to accept that there might have been something bigger and more evil behind this horrible event than a lone gunman.
Well, it's sort of released too, and I mean, maybe in a sense you said that we the American people aren't getting the full story, that there are dark forces behind major decisions in our country, that it's not all democracy and voting and the Congress and what have you, and that that so many of the big decisions are being manipulated by powerful forces, because it sort of unleashed general criticisms of government, and whereas J. Edgar Hoover had gone to such lengths to lionize the G-men. After that, in movies and popular culture, very frequently agents for the government were the bad guys. So.
Well, certainly, you know, the Kennedy assassination and the secrecy and mishandling of the investigation afterwards created I think, a great lack of trust in the American public that has endured and hurt us as a country psychologically for decades now. It's led to corrosive conspiracy theories about the 9/11 attack, for example. It's led to these movies about kind of the vast evils of our own security agencies, and they certainly commit crimes and do awful things. That's true, and we should call them to account for that. Like the debate over the National Security Agency's, you know, domestic and international spying that we're engaged in right now. But that's what's healthy about this, is to continue to debate it. And luckily for us in the Kennedy assassination issue, the one good thing that came out of Oliver Stone's movie, JFK.
Can I do this for you? Let me interrupt you. I just see that this is going to click us off automatically. I asked you a big question and not letting you get a big answer. And Peter Kornbluh has been my guest. And you can go to NS Archive, singular, nsarchive.org. There's a tremendous amount of information. Peter Kornbluh's article, The Darkest Day, appears in the November issue of Cigar Aficionado, where he expands greatly on all of this.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call.
What you're supposed to do to take care of your tires by Micro. You know, I don't really know what you're supposed to do. You know who does, though? The tire experts in the service department at your Ford dealership.
Get up to $140 in mail-in rebates on 4 select tires when you use the Ford Service Credit Card. Click on the banner now. Subject to credit approval, rebates by check. Other tire manufacturer rebate or offer cannot be combined or Ford Service Credit Card rebate or offer. See your participating Ford dealer for rebate details through 12/31/13.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I think you know my abiding interest in history and the importance of it to understand what we're doing today and where we're going to go from today to tomorrow. And I don't think I've lived in a period as critical as this. Future looks kind of scary, and we always can depend, I think, in my estimation, of certain people that give us a good clue, not only of, for instance, what happened in the past, but give us an idea of how to read the future and the present for ourselves. One of those people was Howard Zinn, and Howard Zinn died at age 87 in January of 2010. If you're a longtime listener of this broadcast, you know I've interviewed him any number of times, and he was so prolific, and he not only did he have his huge People's History of the United States, 1492 to the present, which was first published in 1980 and updated any number of times, which has sold over 2 million copies. I mean, this is a history book, right? But his writings appeared in many different places. He was generous always with his time, and one of the repositories of his essays was in the Progressive magazine. I interviewed the editor, Matthew Rothschild, about 3 years ago during the 100th anniversary of the Progressive magazine. You can go to progressive.org. And Matthew Rothschild has the foreword in the historic Unfilled Promise, Howard Zinn's essays that appeared in the Progressive magazine. It's a pleasure to welcome back Matthew Rothschild at his office in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, you know, you say the foreword. I should have asked you this off the air. Did you also select these, or, and essentially are the editor of this volume as well?
No, I didn't edit it. My friends over at City Lights Publishing out in San Francisco edited it. We sent them all the essays that Howard Zinn wrote for the Progressive over the years, and he wrote for us steadily in the last 12 years of his life and wrote occasionally prior to that, but it was one of the great joys of my tenure here as editor, now coming on 20 years, working with Howard Zinn, who was a delightful man. I mean, you know, Peter, a lot of people with big reputations have even bigger egos, and that wasn't true of Howard Zinn, or at least he knew how to tuck his in, because he was just a delightful man. He had a great sense of humor, but, you know, the wisdom just pours forth from every page in this book, and it was fun for me just over the last 15 minutes to leaf through it again in preparation for our talk, because I hadn't gone over it for a while, and there, you know, I think anyone who wants to introduce themselves or their kids to
a really profound look at U.S. history and world history over the last 20 years should get this little paperback. It's so accessible, too. I mean, he writes real clearly, real comprehensively, and these are short essays, so you can read one a night before you go to bed without any trouble.
Yeah, it's kind of extraordinary, particularly a history book like A People's History of the United States, that probably a good number of people in the audience that have had to read history books probably would groan at the thought of having to read history. Yet everything he writes in that book is exciting. And what we're talking about in the Howard Zinn, The Historic Unfulfilled Promise, looks at contemporary issues in many of them, right?
Yeah, he talks a lot about the Iraq War. He talks about the Afghanistan War. He talks about Obama. The unfulfilled promise, the historic unfulfilled promise that he talks about is, of course, democracy. He writes in the first essay here that we need to move toward the ideals of egalitarianism, community, and self-determination. And he called that whole concept democracy. So it's about democracy. It's about human rights for every single individual. It's about freedom, and it's about justice. So, and it also, you know, he wasn't a scowly leftist. You know, he wasn't someone who was always just screaming and yelling and raging at the world. I mean, he could rage sometimes, but he also told jokes, and he also really loved the arts. He loved the actors and the writers and the musicians and the poets, and he understood that they could reach people, and here maybe have been a bit of modesty on his part, that they could reach people more directly than himself writing an editorial or someone less gifted writing editorials like me. So that was also a dimension of his that was so nice to see, because a lot of times you can see political figures, whether they're on the left or the right, and one, they don't seem to have a funny bone in their body, and number two, they're just kind of tedious. And neither was the case with Howard Zinn.
Howard Zinn, the historic unfilled promise, unfulfilled promise, is the book we're talking about. It's published by City Lights Books. And I'm talking with Matthew Rothschild. He is the editor of the Progressive magazine, and you can go to progressive.org, find both of them, both the information about the magazine. The magazine is over 100 years old, and and also the information about the book is there as well. You were talking about his Howard Zinn's accessibility. I know the first time I ever talked to him, I thought, well, this guy is going to, I'm probably have to go through about three or four layers of his people. So I called this number, and this woman says, hello. And I went, oh, I'm sorry, I was looking for Howard Zinn. She said, oh, this is his house. This is Mrs. Zinn. And I said, well, I'd like to talk to him. And she says, Howard. And, you know, he came to the phone. And I said, wow. I said, you just have your phone number available like that? And he said, yeah. I said, don't you ever get weird calls, because he's reviled and despised by the right wing? And he said, oh, once in a while. But, you know, he didn't seem to care. I mean, he was just there for us, wasn't he?
He was just really down to earth. That was the wonderful thing about him. I remember when he gave a talk here, not only at our 100th anniversary celebration, but earlier on, and he was real tired at the end. He must have been at least 75 at that time, and people were just, you know, coming up to him after his talk and getting autographs and asking him questions, and he just lingered and lingered and lingered, which I thought was nuts. I was ready to act as a bodyguard and get him out of there, but no, he waited, and then at the very end, he wanted to go. I asked him for drinks, and he said, no, what I really wanted was a milkshake. So we just went over to the nearest ice cream place, and we've got good ice cream here in Madison, Wisconsin. And he went in the little shop and ordered a chocolate malt and kept signing people's papers who were in there. There were four or five customers, and three of them must have recognized him. So, but that's how he was. You know, he didn't have airs. He didn't think he was better than anybody else.
Yeah, yet an historian who people are seeking his autograph. That's very, very strange. Matthew Rothschild, when, like, all of these essays in the book, The Historic Unfulfilled Promise, which way would it go? Would he call you and say, hey, I gotta write something about this? Or did you call him and say, Howard, we need, which way did it go?
It went both ways. It was a real two-way street. So, for instance, when Kurt Vonnegut died, instantly thought, well, Howard Zinn, Kurt Vonnegut, they're about the same age. They had experiences fighting in World War II. They both became pacifists, essentially. And I thought they must have known each other for years and years, so I asked Howard if he would write a column, a eulogy for Vonnegut, and as it turns out, he had only gotten to know Vonnegut in about the last 10 years of his life, but they had a great friendship, and they did have so much in common, so that was one that he brought to us. But oftentimes, he would be writing something, he'd email me and say, you know, take a look at this. If you don't think it's any good, of course, you don't need to publish it. Yeah. You know, that was him being humble, or at least fake humble, and I give points for both, you know. Actually, I interviewed him once on radio, and I said, boy, you're either humble or you fake it real well. And he laughed and said, is that a compliment?
Yeah, he certainly would. You would almost not think he was an academic. I mean, both you and I know academics, and most of them are wonderful people. Most of them don't put on airs. But there was something about him, and maybe it was Howard Zinn's origins as coming from an immigrant family and, you know, working in industrial plants. And I mean, give us just a little thumbnail of Howard Zinn's personal history.
Yeah, I mean, he grew up in a real working-class family in New York. His father was a waiter his whole life, and it really bothered Howard Zinn that the bosses who were running the restaurant or hotel where his father worked would treat him with such disdain, even though his father was excellent at what he did and worked real hard, and yet the class structure there, even in that restaurant and hotel, was imprinted on Howard early on, and so he was fighting that his whole life too. And you know, he understood that it was important, you know, to speak plainly to people. I know a lot of academics don't want to speak that plainly and want to show off their knowledge by using huge words or something. That wasn't a game that Howard Zinn played. He didn't want to play that Ivy League, here's my SAT verbal score game. You know, he wanted to reach as many people as possible. And, mm-hmm. and that's a real political task. He wanted to tell people how he saw the world in hopes of improving the world. And so he didn't want to, it wasn't about him. It wasn't about Howard. It was about making the world a better place. And so if that's your mission, you don't want to, you know, draw attention to yourself and exclude others by talking in some obscure, pedantic language.
Yeah, that's why his book, A People's History of the United States, has sold over 2 million copies. He doesn't use, trope and a lead and discourse. And
right, and I think it's one of the reasons why some historians would try to put him down. One, they were jealous. I mean, who has ever published a history book, you know, that's sold one-tenth or one-hundredth of what A People's History of the United States has sold? So they were jealous about that. And so in the petty academic way, people would say, well, this is pop history or something. Well, don't you want people to understand what history is? So why don't you explain it to them in ways that they can understand?
You know, I was actually going to bring that up. I could imagine. In fact, maybe we need a little clarity for our listeners as well, people that are not familiar with the people's history of the United States, that its historiography, how it approached the history of the United States. But I was almost shocked at the level of criticism that some historians have made of that 2 million seller book. Tell us just, you know, what his basic premise was for writing A People's History of the United States, and it shows up all through Howard Zinn, the historic unfulfilled promise as well.
His whole orientation was not to write a history of presidents or of generals or of senators or any of the so-called important people in U.S. history. His orientation was to write a people's history, what people were doing, how people were fighting back. He understood that there was conflict at the very beginning, conflict when Columbus landed here. So his description of Columbus discovering America is quite different than you found in the history books when you and I were growing up, Peter. He talks about how the Indians were decimated, how Columbus and his people were terrorizing the Indians, and how the Indians were fighting back. He would talk about slave rebellions, and he would talk then, you know, Shays' Rebellion in 1789 after, or 1787, after the American Revolution, when farmers in western Massachusetts started to rebel because they were getting ripped off. And so he was always defending the people who were getting ripped off and being exploited, and especially highlighting those people who were fighting back. So that really is the whole framework of Howard Zinn's history and of his columns.
You know, I was looking at one of the criticisms, and this seemed so contradictory to the Howard Zinn that you, Matthew Rothschild, and I knew. It would say that, it says, a hatred of mankind is the dominant tone of Zinn's book. This comes from the historian Oscar Handlin, who was a big deal at Harvard. So he says that Howard Zinn hated mankind. That's the dominant tone of Zinn's book. I'm thinking, which book did he read?
I mean, it is amazing, isn't it? I mean, this conservative historian out of the ivyest of the Ivy Leagues condemning Howard Zinn, who was at Boston University, but before that was at Spelman College in the South, teaching Alice Walker and some other people who were very active in the civil rights movement, actually getting arrested down there in support of the civil rights movement. That's how courageous he was. But I can't think of any writer who loved people more than Howard Zinn did, so, and loved mankind. What he hated was exploitation. What he hated was bullying. You know, bullying is probably the basic, the reflex against bullying is probably the most basic democratic and progressive impulse that there is. And Howard Zinn had that impulse. You barely had to tap his knee and his leg would go out if he saw some bullying going on. Mm-hmm. And that he wrote against bullying. And to write against bullying is to love mankind, and that's what he did.
You know, you mentioned in passing that that both he, Howard Zinn, and Kurt Vonnegut had seen service in World War II, and yet had become pacifist. And he explains this, and I'm trying to put my mind together with which book of his sort of his memoirs that he talked about that. But first, how did this pacifism, and was it really a pacifism? Did he believe in, you know, like ultimate pacifism? Or
no, it wasn't ultimate pacifism, Peter, but it was close. I mean, in his memoir that you were referring to, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train,
right.
He talked about being an eager bombardier with the U.S. military in France in the waning days of World War II and dropping what was the functional equivalent of napalm on some villages there. And at the time, he wasn't horrified, but the more he thought about his experience, he was horrified about not only his role in war, but war, period, and then tried for the rest of his life to agitate for the abolition of war. And that's really what drove him. And I remember going to his memorial service and hearing his daughter talk about ending war being the most important thing in his whole life. I mean, there are plenty of issues here in this book and in it, people's history that he was devoted to, but that was uppermost in his mind. He wasn't totally a pacifist. He said there are some justifications for a very limited amount of force at particular times if they can prevent astronomical violence to come. But he didn't like what he called organized terrorism, which is war, full-fledged war, one nation against another.
The book is The Historic Unfilled I haven't said that right once. The Historic Unfulfilled Promise by Howard Zinn. It's essays that were collected from the Progressive Magazine. My guest is Matthew Rothschild. He is the editor of the Progressive Magazine. It goes back over 100 years of incredible history, and you can go to progressive.org. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E .com. Let's get to the book. Now, you said that City Lights, a wonderful imprint, and I do lots of authors from that, citylights.com, they selected the essays from all the progressive columns that he had written in your magazine. The book's about 250 pages. Was there any that you said, ooh, I wish it was like 265 because there was one great one that got left out?
Oh, you know, I did. I just did because there was an essay he wrote in 2005 called The Scourge of Nationalism.
Huh.
The Scourge of Nationalism, in which he says people should put away their flags and not sing the anthems and move beyond patriotism, move beyond nationalism, and understand that we're all one people in this world and we all have equal rights and claims to freedom and equality and democracy in this world. So that was a real lovely column, one of my favorites, and I was just thinking as I was going through the book, God, I wish I had begged the people at City Lights to put that one in too, but there was so much to draw on. You know, I don't blame editors typically since I am one.
Well, you know, Matthew, just as you said that, I bet you, speaking to flags, a lot of flags went, whoa, wait a minute, this guy does not want to honor the symbols of the United States of America, the flag, the national anthem. I mean, this guy really must be anti-American.
Well, I think this is one of the most challenging concepts that he put forward, this idea that we should question the need for patriotism or the accepted notion that we are the greatest country in the world or that the best country ever in the world. And this is something that isn't natural, but it is, you know, it is driven into us. It's something that's inculcated into us by our parents or by the schools or by the TV or by the government. And his view was that this patriotism can be toxic, that it can lead to nationalism, and the nationalism can lead governments to take us into illegal wars like George W. Bush did in Iraq, and it can lead to atrocities. And so it's a real cautionary tale, and I think it's a hard one for I would say probably 95% of Americans to grapple with. And I know my dad flew the American flag out front of his house his whole life. He was a World War II vet, and I know we didn't see eye to eye on this one, but I've come around to Howard Zinn's view on this, and it's just I think we all as thinking people need to wrestle with ideas that are given to us. Do we accept those ideas? Are those ideas valid? Why are they valid? Maybe they're valid in some times and not valid in others, rather than just passively accept them. And he was never one to passively accept a received idea.
Well, let's do this. We have about 5 or 6 minutes remaining, and we've never really gotten into the content of Howard Zinn, the historic unfulfilled promise. And these are essays from the Progressive magazine. My guest is the editor of the magazine, Matthew Rothschild, and you can go to progressive.org for information on the book and on the magazine. And, hey, support print. Matt and I were talking about that before we started recording this, but that's another story. But take us through just a couple of these, and rather than randomly, tell, you know, and I think when you run a publication like I have in the past, it's okay to be proud of what you've done. And are there any specific ones in here that you are saying, damn, I'm proud to be associated with this magazine that could print this essay by Howard Zinn right at this time when it was so critical? Are there ones in there like that?
Sure, and I felt that way almost with every one, but you know, there was an essay in here where he, and following up on the patriotism argument that we were just discussing, where he talked about U.S. soldiers who died in the Iraq War. He wrote they did not die for their country, and of course they were always told they were dying for their country, but he was brave enough to say they didn't die for their country, they died for their government. They died for Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld, and yes, they died for the greed of the oil cartels, for the expansion of the American empire, for the political ambitions of the president. They died to cover up the theft of the nation's wealth, to pay for the machines of death. To me, those are really challenging thoughts, too, because every time a president tells people to go to war, he says, you know, you're going to die for the country, you're not going to die in vain. And are they really dying for the country, or the people who are dying for the people who are sending them over there, or the people and forces behind the president and the generals who are sending them over? So that certainly was one of those essays that struck me as really hitting an important and controversial, but I think fundamental point. Another one was, and this is a theme that runs throughout Howard Zinn's writing, and that is that governments, even dictatorships and power structures that are oppressive, are more vulnerable than we think they are. And certainly this came true in the Arab Spring when we saw Hosni Mubarak and the dictatorship of Egypt fall, when we saw the Soviet Union collapse, when we saw the apartheid government collapse. I mean, these are amazing things that happen. When they happen, they surprise us. They didn't surprise Howard Zinn because he understood that governments are fragile. The power of government, whatever weapons it possesses, he wrote, whatever money it has at its disposal, he said, is fragile.
when it loses its legitimacy in the eyes of its people, its days are numbered. And so he concluded, we need to engage in whatever nonviolent actions appeal to us. There is no act too small, no act too bold. The history of social change, he said, is the history of millions of actions, small and large, coming together at critical points to create a power that governments cannot suppress. To me, that is an inspiring message, because too often people think we can't do anything about it. We're powerless. It's always going to be this way. I might as well give up. And he rebutted each one of those claims. And to me, that gives us the inspiration we need to carry on and try to improve this country.
Howard Zinn seemed like a man who would always be with us. He lived to 87. He was very vigorous. In fact, he died while swimming in California in 2010. And he seems irreplaceable, which is, on one hand, is an incredible tribute to the man, but doesn't bode well for what we want to say, what the Progressive magazine wants to say. Are there people that, and I don't know, either names or just in general, people that can fill Howard Zinn's shoes?
Well, I think he would answer, and certainly I would answer, that he wouldn't want people to fill his shoes, and that there are millions of shoes out there that are being filled today that we should look at. And it's not necessarily someone who's on everybody's lips or who sells 2 million copies of a history book, but it's people who are out there marching on the picket lines, you know, whether it's against Palermo's Pizza in Milwaukee, where there's a strike right now, or tomato pickers in Florida, or, you know, trying to protect people who are being foreclosed upon in Detroit. I mean, he would say those are the people who whose shoes we need to notice. And I think he's right about that. Too often history is of, you know, the most famous, even the most famous people on the left. And that wasn't something that interested him all that much.
Well, the book is an incredible collection of the essays of historian the late Howard Zinn. The book is called The Historic Unfulfilled Promise. The foreword is by Matthew Rothschild, and he is the editor of the Progressive magazine, the 100-year-old Progressive, as it says, Progressive magazine. You go to progressive.org, and there'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And it's published by City Lights. That's citylights.com. The Noam Chomsky has said, Howard Zinn's life and work are an unforgettable model, sure to leave a permanent stamp on how history is understood and how a decent and honorable life should be lived. It all comes clear in this book. Matthew Rothschild, thanks again for being on the on my program.
Peter, it's been my pleasure, and I look forward to it again.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or sponsors of WRIF Radio or of its parent company, Greater Media Incorporated. Stay tuned. There's more rock coming right up on 101 WRIF, everything that rocks. Night Call. Night Call.
These days, when I'm in a relationship, I feel like I'm alone.
Like there's no one behind the mask. No voice on the other end of the line.
Are you looking for a car insurance policy totally devoted to you? At Geico.com, you'll find a sympathetic ear, a shoulder to cry on, butterfly kisses, and easy ways to pay your bill and manage your policy. We're waiting with bated breath to help you save money and talk about your feelings. Geico. 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
What you're supposed to do to take care of your tires, by Mike Rowe. You know, I don't really know what you're supposed to do. You know who does, though? The tire experts in the service department at your Ford dealership.
Get up to $140 in mail-in rebates on 4 select tires when you use the Ford Service Credit Card. Click on the banner now. Subject to credit approval, rebates by check. Other tire manufacturer rebate or offer cannot be combined or Ford Service Credit Card rebate or offer. See your participating Ford dealer for rebate details through 12/31/13.
Hey, music lovers. Tired of your music buffering while you're running around? Here's a reality check. Verizon's 4G LTE is the most reliable and in more places than any other 4G network. Reliability you can believe in. That's powerful. Verizon. Click on the banner to compare the maps.
This is your Biotech Minute. Biotechnology, a big word for an area of cutting-edge science that is improving the world we live in. In health, biotech provides breakthrough therapies and treatments for devastating diseases like cancer, MS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and HIV/AIDS. Biotechnology is also helping farmers produce more crops from existing acreage, reducing fuel use and greenhouse gas emissions, and it's creating fuels from renewable green energy sources like algae and plant waste. And this is just the beginning. The biotechnology research being done in laboratories today will improve the health and quality of our lives and our world for generations that follow. Biotechnology, helping heal, fuel, and feed the world. A public service message from this station and the Biotechnology Industry Organization.
Back to the Rock on the Riff.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Oh, you're on
the Riff.
what you know about sacrifice.